This is Jim Alger, and this is Common Sense.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
Why do the Republicans hate America?
Their only play right now in Congress is to hope the Democratic Party fails.
It's not even us in the U.S. It's us in China now.
It's us in China.
It's going to be us, Russia, and China.
It's
the EU. We're in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression.
The buzzword of the day is not torture. The buzzword of the day is enhanced interrogation techniques. Can we just agree to call it torture?
Ask what you can do for your country.
Hope you're having a great day in Washington, D.C., or wherever in the world you're tuning the show in today. This is Common Sense, the show that cuts through the spin of the anti-American right-wing nuts and brings it to you straight.
During our show, we'll help you, the listener, try and understand the week's events and what we as a nation can do about it. Our job here is not to change your mind, but provide political perspective and act as your voice to power.
In short, we are here to have a discussion and help you replace the spin with common sense. Good evening, everyone. Live from New York today, it's Common Sense Radio. With me today is our usual co-host in crime. We have Christine down in New Jersey. Say hi, Chris.
Hello.
And our trusted compatriot, Mike, is out in Los Angeles. Say hi to everyone, Mike.
Hey, good evening, everybody.
Today on the show, first up, we're going to be talking about North Korea. Then we're going to be have a discussion about Prop 8 and what happened out there in California with the gay marriage proposal with Proposition 8 that went to court. After that, we're going to have a guest from Liberty University to discuss the Democrats that were ejected, the Democratic Club was ejected off campus down there. Then we're going to talk about the never-ending saga of Roland Burris and Blagojevich in Illinois. Is Roland Burris actually guilty of a crime, or is he really exposing what goes on every day in politics? That'd be a very interesting discussion, I'm sure. Then we're going to have another guest on. We're going to discuss the GM bankruptcy and the economy overall. It's really kind of a mixed bag here going on with the economy. So we'll be discussing that. And, of course, we would be remiss if we did not have a in-depth conversation regarding the Supreme Court justice nominee that we called 2 weeks ago here on Common Sense. And that is Justice Sotomayor and the controversies, of course, swirling around her. Chris, we'll cap up the end of the show with a wrap-up of the governor races in New Jersey and Virginia, where the Republicans are hoping to pick up a couple of seats and pick off what they believe may be vulnerable seats, although I personally think they're counting chickens way before they hatch there. And we're going to have a little discussion later on regarding a Pennsylvania paper that thought it was a great idea to publish a ad suggesting the assassination of a president. That is quite a interesting show we're going to have here today. So first up on the show, North Korea, guys. They've been having fun and kind of ticking people off. The U.S. Is reporting they have launched missiles, and now we're saying that they are preparing to launch more missiles as we speak. They're saying they're going to retaliate if the United Nations imposes sanctions against them. You know, guys, correct me if I'm wrong, but this really sounds to me like an irate teenager that really needs to get his butt spanked around. What do you think?
No, I agree with the president. It sounds like saber-rattling, although it's difficult to tell what exactly North Korea is after. You know, they want they want concessions. They want things from us. But this doesn't seem like, to me, the way to get it.
No, it's certainly it may be saber-rattling, but it's a pretty big saber.
Mm. I have to give props to Chris for a statement last week that was probably a little ahead of its time. Know that pass? Why can't we send this guy down it?
Yeah, really. With the teenage, he sounds like an irate teenager. That's actually almost a compliment to him. This guy, Kim Jong-il sounds like a toddler. I mean, he knows that the country is completely isolated and they have nothing, absolutely nothing to come to the bargaining table with, and they want something. You're exactly right with that. But instead of using manners, kind of saying, hey, you know, let's offer something. They're saying, no, if you don't give us this, you know, we're going to fire test missiles at the world, and it's just completely ass backwards.
You know, it's really sad because, you know, we talk about this in our own country, like, should we be justified in spending this amount of money on warfare or name your project when there are so many people in poverty? But talk about true poverty. There, North Korea is a country that's going after nuclear missiles, that is militarizing at a phenomenal rate, and they've had starvation there recently. I don't think the average American has any idea what it's like in that country. People literally walk around wearing pins of the great leader. There's huge statues dedicated to him. And something that I found funny, they came up with a new hybrid flower, and they named it a Kim Jong Iliad. I mean, it's really a kind of a brainwashing going on.
They are. They're completely brainwashed. They're raised that way. In every house, I believe, they are required to have a picture of the great leader. And this guy, actually, the only music that they're allowed to play and the songs that they're allowed to sing are songs that are dedicated to him. People actually get arrested and thrown in jail for years at a time if they do something that's, you know, totally off the wall, like sing a song that's not on the official list of, you know, songs that they that are approved by their leader.
Well, I mean, to me, as interesting as a lot of that stuff is, I, for one, don't know that I care about what's going on in their country per se. Because that's kind of their own internal issues. It's kind of interesting to look at, though. What I'm concerned about is, you know, so far we've seen a lot of launches, both from the east and west coasts of Korea. We've seen an underground nuclear detonation take place in the last week. We have these threats against South Korea, threats against the United States. We have a claim, basically a declaration of war against the United States in the past week. Yeah, I mean,
I don't really think you can separate the two issues. I mean, the fact that they're a fascist country and the manner in which he rules kind of directly leads to this other problem.
Well, I actually would agree with you in that according to him, it's his way or no way. And, you know, he does have, I believe the numbers I have are that they have 8,000 spent fuel rods that, if reprocessed, could allow them 13 to 18 pounds of plutonium. And that's an issue. That's a huge security issue for the entire globe. I mean, he could make a nuclear bomb out of this, and they... we already know that they have enough plutonium for a good couple of atomic bombs.
You know what's amazing? I go back to Iraq and what was being said before we went into Iraq, or early thereafter. You know, we went into Iraq because it was suggested that Saddam Hussein was getting his hands on nuclear weaponry or had it already. And here, even back then, we knew that what this guy was doing and that he was actively pursuing it, and yet look at the reaction.
I remember there was a skit on a radio station in L.A. that they were talking about where this guy was jumping up and down and saying, what do I have to do? you care about them. You don't care about me. And
yeah,
what
hey, look, hey, I have the bomb. What are you doing? Exactly. And it's still amazing to this day.
Well, it is interesting to note that during the last administration, they said that Bill Clinton's placating North Korea allowed it to get to this point. But the Bush administration was there for 8 years and didn't do a damn thing. I mean, the situation is there anybody who's willing to take the position? The situation with North Korea is not worse now than it was 8 years ago or 16 years ago. My point exactly.
It is. Well, it is in a way. I mean, North Korea had agreed to disable their reactor 2007 in exchange for aid to their country, and they did they demolished one of their cooling towers that is part of the nuclear bomb process or bomb making process. So, to that extent, we were kind of better off. I hate to say it because I hate to admit that, you know, when George Bush is right, but his diplomacy worked in one regard. Now they went from disarming to threatening to attack. They are threatening right now to attack South Korea if South Korea stops their ships from going in and out.
Well, does anybody know what led to the recent change? Because it seems to me that, yeah, you're right, they're kind of on again, off again. They've played ball for a while with the international community, and then sometimes they just want to say, no, we're going off on our own direction. And I'm wondering if there's something I'm not seeing here that triggered that.
Well, part of it, the understanding that I have, is that there were reports of Kim Jong-il having a stroke a few months ago, and that his grip on power in North Korea is, I'm not going to say dwindling, because that's probably an overstatement, but mm-hmm. that there's issues with it. And so to reinforce his strength and his rule, he's doing a lot of this nonsense. To me, it's counterproductive in a huge way.
Well, that does make sense, though, that he is pulling this shenanigans in order to make, you know, and again, when you have a country that's run with an iron fist like this, you have to enforce that. Yeah, you have to maintain that type of power.
He has a Napoleon complex. He's about, what, 5'0" You know, with his little heels on. And his problem is, yes, he had a stroke, or what we suspect is a stroke, and his ego has taken a beating, and now he is basically trying to demonstrate to his country, because his power is only predicated upon the commitment of his military to protect him, and he's trying to demonstrate how wonderful he is. Ooh, look, I have missiles. You know, that is the mentality of a toddler. You know, if you don't do what I want you to do, I'm going to take my toys and go play in my own sandbox.
Yes, but here's my concern. At one point, if you have a toddler who's taking swings at you, you can hold him off with your hand and look at him as he swings and can't reach you. But when you have a toddler that possesses nuclear weapons, that's a very dangerous and irrational human being. I have a toddler. Rationality and my son John collide that often in the same sentence. They want what they want. They want it now. What I'm seeing with South Korea seems to mimic this type of childish behavior of, I'm just going to be – when you are threatening the United Nations, which is basically – I had a tweet that came to us earlier, and the gentleman said, basically said, hello world, F you, North Korea. And you know what? That really does just about put what these guys are doing. They are even losing some of the support of Japan right now. Now, I apologize. They never had support of Japan.
Not at all.
Yeah.
This is why I have more than one person on the show. See, it's when you start losing China, that's a very serious problem for these guys.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, China's the whole reason that they exist.
And the key here now, that the difference between now and before, is that the sanctions that we had levied against them with regard to the international community, they never had real teeth. They never had the commitment of China. We do now. China has come out and publicly
Well, China is not saying they're going to support new sanctions yet. We've yet to see what China is going to do in the United Nations. But yes, China has definitely shown that they're not happy with what's going on, which is frankly an improvement. But I have not seen anything.
China has said that it is, quote, resolutely opposed to their nuclear tests.
Yes.
Now,
does that mean that they're going to do anything about it?
You're right. That is the question, but it's a huge difference. It's they've never said anything before. They've never made any kind of public statement or any kind of commitment.
I agree 100%. By the way, for the folks listening on air, 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. Give us a call. Come on the air. Join the discussion. We're talking about North Korea and his apparent inferiority complex over there. Right now, you can also Twitter at Jim Alger. That's the @ and Jim Alger. Feel free to Twitter us as well. And we have our little feed going here on the side, and we are watching the tweets as they come in, although we'd much rather have you on the phone so we can engage in discussion. If you missed that number, it's 888-228-4494. We harass them every week to call us, and every week they Twitter us. So nonetheless, proceeding forward with this conversation, I think that that the issue with China, like you're alluding to, is that if they don't step up the play, I mean, it seems to me like North Korea is creating a scenario where China is not going to have a choice. This is China's Katrina.
I believe
where
that.
Finally it's the watershed moment that has just pushed things over the brink, and they cannot support this guy anymore.
China is key. I mean, they're the dominant power in the region. They're the reason North Korea exists separate from South Korea in the first place. And if this is true, that they're signaling a change in position, this might be the beginning to actually getting somewhere. I think we in the United States are kind of limited into what we can do. I mean, we can't really just go into combat with them. I mean, this talk about upsetting China and the whole region. I have a feeling that sanctions don't work really well against the fascist government. You put in sanctions, they maintain power, the people of the country suffer. It doesn't really yield you the results you want. I mean, look at how long we've gone on with Cuba. Hasn't changed that government. And it really is going to require international pressure, and especially action on the part of China and the regional powers to be. To get something out of this guy.
Let's also kind of keep in mind why it is that we care about this. I got a tweet here from a gentleman who said that he was talking to friends of his in the Philippines and I'm trying to get this gentleman's name. Juan Keko is his Twitter name. And he said he's been corresponding with people in Japan and people in the Philippines, and they say that it's not news there at all. And how come is it? Why is it news here? Is this our media sensationalizing it? Is this what they want, attention? Well, if by they you mean North Korea, yes, they want attention. The reason that this is such big news here in the United States is because of what Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the day before yesterday, which was some viewed as a warning shot to North Korea, but it just is what it is, and that is that we are duty-bound by treaty to defend South Korea. So when North Korea threatens to down South Korean aircraft, we then will retaliate by treaty against North Korea. Now you're talking about without it's not that far of a stretch to see with 38,000 of our troops between North Korea and South Korea in the DMZ, and North Korea, South Korea and the United States doing reconnaissance flights over North Korea. And North Korea threatening to shoot down those aircraft, including a South Korean aircraft, that we are duty-bound to retaliate against should that happen. It is not difficult to see how this becomes a military conflict in very short order. And if North Korea downs South Korea and a South Korea aircraft, we then retaliate against North Korea. North Korea then pushes down into Seoul, and we have ourselves a ball game. And that is what we are concerned about. That is why it is such big news. Now, is that going to happen? I doubt it. But
And here's...
It's anybody's guess, because what's the end game? He's got to know he can't win this, but...
Well, I have a quote from a North Korean newspaper that basically is saying that they
paper?
Don't... The North Korean newspaper is called the, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, but Minju Joseon.
Okay.
And the quote is, "It is laughable delusion for the United States to think that it can get us to kneel with sanctions. We've been living under U.S. sanctions for decades, but have firmly safeguarded our ideology and system while moving our achievements forward. The U.S. sanctions policy toward North Korea is like striking a rock with a rotten egg." End quote.
I wouldn't be concerned about sanctions for the United States. I'd be concerned about the United States Air Force. So these guys, obviously it's a state-run paper. It's more propaganda and more garbage. The issue here is, you know, how do we avoid a military conflict? Because we don't want one. I'd venture to say that North Korea doesn't want one, because the reality is if China stood down, then we would have the ability to get in there and get out. I mean, I think the concern right now would China be drawn into any military conflict with North Korea?
Well, China doesn't want to engage, or hasn't, I suppose I should say, in the past. They have not wanted to join, the sanctions and the international community against North Korea for the reason that they don't want any kind of overflow with the refugees. They don't want them coming to China. You know, so... if they weaken the government, you know, with Kim Jong-il, then that would be the end result. Those people would end up going. There's so many of them, and China already has plenty of people.
Issue as well. As I understand it, they're allies.
They are, yeah. Mutual communist countries.
Well... and are they supporting him for that reason alone, or are they just opposing the United States because it's a fun thing to do?
Well, they're all, I mean,
or is
also,
that just a bonus?
There's a lot of that as well. I mean, we can't forget that, you know, Russia, China, and we're guilty of this too, have taken the other side just for the fact of containing, you know, the United States influence and taking the other side. I mean, when we were in that war, there were Russian pilots in what were supposed to be North Korean fighter jets. This type of thing still continues.
I think the difference now is that before, you know, North Korea hadn't tried to flex their military muscles or their nuclear muscles. And so it was safe for China to kind of sit back and say, okay, you guys do the work, because we don't, you know, want to put ourselves into it. But now that they have demonstrated nuclear capability, that kind of changes the entire ballgame. They now are a threat, a very real threat to them. They've tested, I believe it at this point, is 6 different missiles from short range to long range, and now it is in China's best interest to say, whoa, however many people are going to come across the border, we can deal with that, as opposed to having part of our country nuked.
Well, I think the serious question is whether or not they could launch a nuclear weapon that would land in the United States anyway. It doesn't seem like, all of a sudden North Korea is claiming that satellite test they were doing weeks ago was in fact a long-range ICBM test. And they kind of got laughed at because it fell flat in the ocean. And they didn't like being laughed at and mocked about it. So this is, they're now escalating it further. South Korea's Yonhap News Agency right now is reporting that North Korea has launched more surface-to-air missiles that are designed to defend against aircraft. It's believed to be a modified version of the Russian SA-5. So they're up to their tricks yet again. The quote coming out of the Foreign Ministry of North Korea says the UN Security Council makes a further provocation. It will be inevitable for us to take further self-defense measures. You really have to wonder, are these guys just completely devoid of reality?
You know what some of this sounds like is, you know, you can look at either of the wars we had in Iraq, and you listen to the bravado and the comments from the other side, and they are completely devoid of reality. You know, you come in and attack us, we'll destroy the United States in 5 days. With what? You've really got to wonder, what is their end game here?
Well, that's my question. What is their end game? I don't know. And if you know,
my hunch is there is a change of regime coming in, and they want to make sure that they have the entire country still within their iron grip. They don't want any. I mean, it's an isolationist country that's been isolated for decades now. They have nothing, but they can only remain in power if that power goes unchallenged. So by saying, hey, look at us, we have these missiles, then it adds to their national unity to let's worship the great, wonderful, supreme leader and all that nonsense. The reality, those people have nothing as far as access to the rest of the world. They have no internet. They have no TV. Everything, you know, newspapers is all provided by the state-approved outlets. So they know nothing. They don't know that the rest of the world is saying, hey, this is bad, hey, you know, whatever. It's completely up to the leader, and he's going down the wrong way.
They also don't have the option in that country of voicing any protest, even if they did have the outside information. You know,
absolutely.
Just like they're saying everything is state controlled. I mean, I don't think people are walking up and down the street with the great leader's pin on their lapel because they really want to show that much support for him.
I don't know. I see a lot of people walking around Barack Obama pins on their lapel.
I don't walk through Los Angeles today and see people all walking down the street with the great leader's pin on their lapel. It's that type of thing you do under duress because you're afraid of being seen as opposition.
True.
It's like Chris is saying, a country's under iron grip, and they have got to do things in order to maintain that. I don't know how far they're willing to go. If they create a national incident, then we are really, you know, it would be a detriment to their own country. It doesn't really make rational sense.
Well, we have questions coming in on Twitter. By the way, if you want to participate in this actual conversation, give us a call at 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. We're getting some questions on Twitter, several of them now, that are asking basically why is China and Russia not doing anything. And I think it's important to note that China, 80% of products sold to North Korea come from China. So there is a serious trade limitation for North Korea, who does seem to be dumb enough to just say, hey, we're going to cut China off. And that would have serious consequences, especially at a time of global recession, which may be another thing that is emboldening North Korea to try and pull some things. They hear that our military is stretched out, that our economy is in tatters, that there's a global recession, in some places depression. So there may be other things that are emboldening them to try and get something. I think the endgame question is the $64,000 question. What do they want? My son acts like a fool. I get it. He wants to watch Barney. What does North Korea want? And maybe can we possibly send Kim Jong-il some Elmo CDs? Would that make him happy?
Send him some Barney CDs. Drive him crazy.
I'm going to send him the Elmo Kills Barney CD.
There you go. No, but as one hypothetical answer to your question, because we don't definitely know that the country is so isolated and mysterious, one possible answer is we don't know if there is a successor to Kim Jong-il. If he dies, you know, if he has had a stroke, as we suspect, then what? Where does the power go to? Who's in line for that succession? We don't know, and maybe he doesn't I don't really want to presuppose to know what's in his mind, but maybe that's what this is all about, because in the past he has done very similar activities and the world has rescued him in the form of China or Russia. They've kind of placated the situation and then gone behind the scenes, and we've gone back to the bargaining table in one way or the other.
You know, another thing to think of is that maybe they want something that we just are not going to be able to give them, and that being recognition, the type of recognition we would give a democracy like South Korea, legitimacy. We've kind of already decided, I'm not saying that's a wrong decision, but we've already decided that this is sort of a rogue nation, that this is an illegitimate leadership, that this is, a suppressive government, and we're not about to change that view.
Let me ask you a question. Who are we to make that conclusion?
Well, I think what Mike is saying is, correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm asking the question. The question is, who are we to make that decision? Are they not a sovereign nation? We deal with, quote-unquote, we're dealing with Muammar Gaddafi, for crying out loud. We are in bed with Saudi Arabia as much as humanly possible. That's a dictatorship by any stretch of the imagination. Why North Korea? I mean, I guess they don't have oil.
And to tie in something somebody said earlier about why is our media picking this up? Is it all sensationalism? Well, as much as I believe our media is sensationalist, this guy's firing missiles. He's developing nuclear weapons.
That's why we care.
This gains the attention of the international community in a very negative way.
And it goes back to the toddler mentality. He doesn't know how to ask politely. He doesn't have any manners for leadership. And this has worked in the past. Go back to 2007. Go back even further from that. He has had his little demonstrations, and we have, through back channels in some way or another, given them concessions.
And going to Jim's point, just to be callous, he's not doing our bidding. These other guys that we are in bed with, they may be dictatorships as well, but they're doing our bidding.
Yep.
Unfortunately, that's true in some cases. I mean, look at Iraq. We were supplying them with weapons at one point, and then years later, we're going to war with them.
Yeah, the Ba'ath Party didn't. Well, not to get off on that tangent, but I agree with you.
The point was that not to really. There may be specifics involved with that I of course didn't get into, but we sometimes will do business with a country for example, Saudi Arabia. That's not a free society by any stretch of the imagination, but they're one of our major trading partners. They have also been an ally of ours, even though a lot of the terrorists that struck us came from that nation. They were very cooperative with helping us hunt them down and doing what they could to combat that. North Korea, not so much. Not really very cooperative at all.
Well, also, your point about being trading partners is exactly why China won't stand up to them.
As far as China being a trading partner to... It's funny when you look behind the scenes of a lot of these issues, how much trade has to do with it.
Personal financial interest.
Oh, gosh, when we were talking about actions that the United States had taken in the Middle East and whether or not the other allies were for it or against it, in some cases it boiled down to whether or not their own oil companies were going to be able to go in there and make deals with the new regime or if they were currently doing business with the old regime. So, unfortunately, when this kind of thing comes into play, you get business is going to corrupt.
Well, good.
Oh, and we certainly can't act like we don't play that game as well.
Well, we do.
I think that the game changer was, it's all fun and games till somebody demonstrates nuclear capability.
Well, I think we've all
Right. Money's one thing, that obviously was China's real intention to protect themselves, but or in the past, but when, you know, crazy leader starts blowing missiles left and right, then that's when money kind of loses its priority. And then it's like, okay, how about some national sovereignty and, you know, protection?
Safety first, money later.
Absolutely.
Well, haven't we also shown people, shown other countries, that we won't attack you if you have nuclear weapons? Haven't we made, haven't we kind of done
nope.
this to a degree to our, name one country that has nuclear weapons that we've attacked.
We've attacked a country that didn't have nuclear weapons.
Yes,
so
name one, have we not shown people that if you do not want to be attacked by the United States, have nuclear weapons. And if we do, you suddenly become, I'm not going to say legitimate, but definitely a more powerful player on the world stage. I'm not saying we go off and attack every country, but I'm saying I do not know of one country that possesses nuclear weapons that we've gone in and attacked.
Well, that this is why, not just for us, this is why they want to pursue them in the first place.
Well, yeah, but the point is it becomes a game changer.
You have the nuclear weapons, and you have the, from what I understand of North Korea, is they have the ability to produce nuclear weapons. Their missile technology is not that great. They don't have it at the present time, and this may be changing, and this may be why our focus is going back to them. They don't have really good delivery technology for these. They don't have nuclear weapon arrays that they could launch in missiles like we do, for example. Once they put those two together, yeah, how can you invade a country that's armed like that?
Well, and that's the whole point.
How can you challenge them?
It becomes a game changer.
I agree.
So I think there's a problem. And so you can kind of see the mentality for our people to say, well, we want to be a sovereign nation. We don't want to get pushed around with the United States, so that's why we want nuclear weapons. I'm not supporting this position. I'm just saying we have to do it. Now we can see the pathway that they get to that conclusion. And then, as Ronald Reagan proved during the 80s, you have to appear to the rest of the world to be crazy enough to use them. And Reagan did a lot of bluster to force Russia, at the time the Soviet Union, to sit down at the table. One could argue, could they not, that this may be a screwy version of Reagan diplomacy?
Well, let me ask this, and see if I can get an opinion on this. Should the United States, and Israel's taken similar action in the past, should the United States be actively, militarily trying to stop North Korea from developing nuclear weapons? I mean, nuclear weapons aren't made in a high school laboratory. They're made at a facility that can be targeted. Should we be doing more?
Well, I would venture to say that if we're going to be the police department for the world, and we're going to uphold UN sanctions and United Nations mandates that nuclear weapons will not be permitted, if that's going to be the policy of the United States, then the answer to that question is an obvious yes. But I don't know that that's necessarily the policy of the United States to go off and attack it. Why? We're sitting here playing games with Iran. Supposedly, we know that they're doing it. So I don't know the answer to that question. 888-228-4494. 888-228-4494. And the backside of the upcoming break here, we're going to shift gears and we're going to talk about Proposition 8, which was upheld in California, essentially, effectively banning gay marriage, but not domestic partnerships and civil unions. However, it upheld the current those people who got married between the time the law allowed them to start, or they started, and the time that this proposition was passed, effectively banning it. So that's going to be an interesting thing on the other side of the break. Coming up right now is Gotta Laugh with her tweet spot, and of course, our commercial break. See you back in 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Have you added up all the hidden costs behind Walmart's prices? The estimated $1.8 billion taxpayers shell out for health care because Walmart doesn't cover their employees. The lost wages of 1.6 million women who had to take Walmart to court to get paid the same as men. The countless manufacturing jobs lost while America's largest corporation became America's biggest importer of Chinese goods. Behind Walmart's profits, the middle class pays the price. America can't afford it any longer.
Welcome to my tweet. It's me, Gotta Laugh, from the Political Carnival blog, and here I am to recap the week in politics via Twitter. This episode of my tweet spot is brought to you by Shredded Tweet, Breakfast of Champions. And now, back to the land of random tweets. Jim Dixon says, I wondered, how can Newt engage in such demagoguery knowing his past statements? My wife replied, his supporters watch Fox. Anna Marie Cox says, oh, the lazy, hazy days of summer in the White House briefing room. Cell phones going off. No one cares. No one's here. Gibbs speaking at normal speed. Now, bloggers like myself, only, you know, famous, are all over Twitter like a photan on the John Boner. Coast blogger Hunter DK says, the road to socialism is paved with children's health care, respect for ethnic people, and tax cuts for the middle class. And Coase himself tweets, whew, good thing Republicans didn't change the Democratic Party's name. We would have been helpless had they proceeded. Here it comes says, I like Palin. She's a fantastic governor who was caricatured by the media. Shock replies, it's hard to caricature a cartoon. And Shock adds, you can always count on a Republican to say, both sides do it, every time their side did it. JFK fan tweets about Pat Buchanan.
You stupid shit!
Pat Buchanan is the type of guy that smuggles sugar and ketchup home from Wendy's with $1 million in his checking account. And now a word from tweeter Cody Kessler. We interrupt this tweet stream to bring you a special announcement. Seat Al Franken! We now return you to your regularly scheduled tweets. She goes on to say, damn, I'll bet George Bush is watching all these recent events and thinking, heh, teleprompter, why didn't I think of that? Ew, I just made myself nauseous. Jim, can you take over while I look for a Tums?
Well, thank you very much. How is everyone doing today? We are going to give out our phone number once again. That is 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494, at Jim Alger on Twitter. Real quickly, we're going to update you on the Proposition 8 things going on out there in California. The California Supreme Court this week upheld, surprisingly enough, Proposition 8, which was a measure passed by the voters, essentially banning gay marriage in the state. However, they did say that they're going to acknowledge the marriages that were done prior to the voters voting in this constitutional amendment. We're actually going to pick this up shortly at the end of this next segment. I did things a little bit out of order. I apologize to our listeners. The first thing we're going to bring up here is Liberty University. And Liberty University, for those who don't know, decided a little while ago that they were going to eject the Democratic Club off their campus and essentially ban them from being able to use the term Liberty University in their literature and so forth. With me on the phone now is Catherine Ford, who is the Vice President of Communications of the Virginia Young Democrats. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jim.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Looks like you've got yourself a little fight going on out there. Could you tell the listeners here what's going on and all the why twos and wherefores?
Sure. Well, what happened initially was Brian Diaz, the president of the Liberty University Young Democrats, received an email from Mark Hine, who is vice president of student affairs at Liberty University, on May 15th, saying that his club was not going to be a recognized organization on campus, and they were to cease using the name Liberty or any other associations. Their website would be taken down and removed from the school's website, and that they were not going to be on campus. So since then, we have been in touch with the administration and we are trying to come to a compromise. They have offered to recharter them as an organization if they charter with Democrats for Life or a similarly minded organization. They have made this crisis about wedge issues, pro-life versus pro-choice. They demanded that the students only support pro-life candidates, and so since then they have they've really made this about the wedge issues and really tried to keep them off campus.
And Catherine, this is Mike here. If I could jump in with a question for you, what exactly did the university do? Did they just ban the group, the club? Did they bar particular students from actually being enrolled in the university? Could you tell the listeners exactly what happened and what the contention with it is?
What Liberty did is they accepted the club. They recognized them as an officially Liberty recognized and credentialed club last October, I believe. And since then, they have disbanded them and decided that they are not.
They disbanded the club. Is it just that the students are still enrolled at the university? They're just not allowed to be in this club. Is that what happened? Would that be correct?
The students are still enrolled at the university as an organization. However, they are not allowed to use Liberty University in their name or literature or organize on campus.
So now, is it just not officially sanctioned by the university, or they are banning them from having anything to do, like, on being on campus?
They are not allowing the organization to organize as the Liberty University Young Democrats on campus or hold any other kind of organizational events.
Well, there's the obvious stifling of free speech, opposing thoughts. I mean, I've often seen that many religious organizations and theological organizations are wide open, of course, to opposing thoughts. Oh wait, never mind, they're not. This Liberty University, for those listeners who may not know, is run by Jerry Falwell's group. And the esteemed Jerry Falwell, was a gentleman who he flat out said that we had 9/11 coming because of Gaydom. This is the type of nonsense we're dealing with. I do have a question on Twitter that says, imagine if this was the Young Republicans at Cal State Berkeley. There is a slight difference, and I know that I'm going to get corrected here, so I'm going to set this up easy for you, Catherine. There's a slight difference that the Cal Berkeley is a state-run institution. Is it not true that a private religious institution has a right to tell people that they don't want to be involved with this?
Well, as Liberty University receives federal money through federally funded students' loans and such, they are accountable for certain rules and for, you know, allowing free speech and those kinds of things that state schools are responsible for as well.
So let me back this up just a hair. Liberty University is saying they don't want their name associated with the Democratic Club. If you guys call the Democratic Club, you know, the Democratic Club of Virginia, would you still be banned from organizing people on campus?
I believe Mark Hines' words were, by using Liberty University and Democrat in the name, the two are associated and the goals of both run in opposite directions. So I believe that regardless of them being chartered as a Virginia Young Democrats chapter, I do not believe that as an organization of students from Liberty University, they would be allowed to organize on campus.
So the obvious follow-up to this would be, are they right? I mean, what is a liberal Democrat doing going to Liberty University?
I think it is a misnomer and misconception that all Christians are Republicans and that Democrats can't be Christian at the same time.
Well, that's not my point. My point is that is it not is not what they what the university said true, that the university does oppose a woman's right to choose. They do oppose gay rights. They do oppose all these wedge issues that are typical staples of Democrats. And therefore, you know, are they do they not have a point when they say that?
Well, as an institution, they may be able to have those points of view, but what they're doing in disbanding the young Democrats, excuse me, is they are they're choosing to disregard their students' point of views, and that's the first priority of a university should be their students and their free thought. And
right.
what they're doing is.
And I'm not disagreeing with you. I agree that students should have the right to free thought and to organize as long as it's legitimate, you know, organization. Of course, there are some things that students are going to want to do that the university should say that they can't. But I agree with you that the university should allow a democratic club, for God's sakes. But as a matter of just law, have you looked into what your legal rights are as far as you mentioned earlier that the university accepts federal money? Does that qualify you for protections that ordinarily a private university wouldn't? Because if you're just saying it's a matter of opinion, or it would be a different situation.
No. Thus far, Virginia Young Democrats has not looked into any legal action. We're just trying to find a compromise to get our chartered club back on campus.
I believe that issue falls under FERPA. And I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure.
For those who don't know the acronym.
And FERPA is?
Oh, the Federal Education Rights Protection Act. I have to actually check on that. I had a thought that I wanted to add real quick, and that is that this is very reminiscent of Obama speaking at Notre Dame, because
yes.
It's one thing, you know, for a university to object based on their principles and whatnot, but it's a completely different beast when a university comes straight out and officially bans, you know, someone or something under the guise that, oh, we don't like you. We don't like what you're saying or what you're thinking. That's it smacks of attacking freedom of thought, because as our guest has said, you know, these students, just because you're Republican or even Democrat, doesn't mean that you can't go to this school. A lot of people grow up, you know, with one ideology,
They're not banging from the school. They're saying they don't want this type of behavior going on campus under their name. Move and Shake is bringing up a very good point, and I know that the latest news is these guys are in trouble with this. He says, how can Liberty University retain tax-exempt status and only recognize the GOP and ban the Democratic Club? And this is goes right into CNS, I think Christian News Service, is reporting that that an organization has asked the Internal Revenue Service review the tax-exempt status of Liberty University after the Christian school dropped its official recognition of a student-run Democratic club. The First Amendment does come to mind, says one of our Twitters here as well. The First Amendment does not apply, generally speaking, to private individuals or companies. We always hear about censorship and free speech, and there is no such thing as censorship and free speech when it's a private organization. However, as Catherine made a very good point, they are taking federal funds. That brings up a whole other kettle of worms here. So there may be an issue. My question for you, Catherine, is that if you feel that the law is on your side, why should we why should you compromise with them at all? Why not just put your foot down and say, we want this and that's it?
I think right now we want to find something that will make both parties happy and make both whole after this is done. If we can't seem to find some kind of reconciliation with the school, I believe that there are certain organizations who have taken up for us on our behalf, who would be willing to bring it to litigation. So, but right now, Virginia Young Democrats is seeking only to charter the club.
Well, very good. I thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a refreshing conversation. It's nice to get the whole side of the story out there. And thank you very much for joining the show.
No, thank you for having me.
Thank you. 888-228-4494 is our phone number. At Jim Alger is the way to reach us on the Twitter. That is this whole Liberty Diversity thing, Mike, brings up a really interesting point, because we often hear about the First Amendment challenges regarding speech on private campuses. This
right. Well, you know, I'd even add that there have been problems on public campuses, and I know we're focusing right now on Liberty University, but I have seen public universities ban books, illegally throw groups off the campus because they had made statements or had content that the university didn't believe in. And I find this disgusting. Universities are supposed to be about, you know, all of their talking points, open-mindedness, free speech, the right to, you know, get into like-minded groups and express your opinion. And we often find that that's not the case if you disagree with the powers to be at the university. And that really does a disservice to the students.
I could not agree more. And that's regardless if you're a left-wing or right-wing university. It's, you know, I find it interesting. So many groups on both sides of the spectrum use the term diversity. And what they really mean is, you know, you're diverse as long as you include our opinions and only our opinions. You're not diverse if you include someone else's opinion so happens to contradict your own. That when we see this in college campuses, whether it be liberal or conservative, the right wing does seem to be taking on a coordinated effort targeting this president. Notre Dame, as Chris mentioned earlier, is part of it. Liberty University seems to be a second part of it. They are really kind of putting their foot down. We saw this. We've seen this for some time now during the campaign, both in 2004 and now. They were saying, well, 2004 was one. The last campaign, they were going after senators, saying the Catholic Church should not provide communion to elected officials who support a woman's right to choose. We really are seeing this compulsion of religious institutions to force their theological views on everyone through our elected leaders or our political action groups. And the First Amendment, while guaranteeing separation of church and state as well as freedom of the press and freedom of speech, the people forget why the separation of church and state exists. It's not to protect the church from the state. It's to protect the state from the church. It's to draw a line, a balance, so that theological views, beliefs that cannot be proven, that are just what I feel, what I believe, cannot be used to rule an entire society.
And, well, you know what I – oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
What I would say is that it's an easy thing to say that we want to have a forum in which we hear everybody's opinion and consider everybody's opinion as equal, but – be it left or right, there we all hold issues which we don't really give any credence at all to the other side. And then when you hear that other side, it just seems unacceptable to you. And I think we run into that problem on both sides. And in some cases, it is unacceptable. For example, you know, there are many issues in which we don't really feel that the other side has a legitimate point of view.
Well, I agree, but this seems to be an issue where it looks like they want to be called the Liberty University Democrats, and Liberty University wants nothing to do with that. So it's going to be interesting to see how this whole thing
Are you saying it's just a matter of what they call the club?
Yeah, that seems to be what it is. From what I got from Catherine, and I asked her several times in several different ways, that it is a matter of they don't want this club using the name Liberty University, and she did seem to feel that they would also stop them from promoting the Democratic Club, although that's not what Liberty University said in their statement. Liberty University said in their statement their objection is using the name Liberty University, thereby affiliating the university with Democratic views that they don't hold.
Well, yeah, we're drawing a fine line here, and it would be nice if we had somebody from university that could give us their side. But
we're not interested in that. You know what? Seriously, if they don't want to allow the Democrats to provide their side of their university, I am in no way, shape, or form interested in having these bozos put their side on our show. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. This, unfortunately, Liberty University, for those of you who may be hearing, hey, I know that name, and I don't quite know where it's from. Well, they had a record number of graduates in the Bush administration. Our infamous DOJ mess came from a woman who graduated from Liberty University. This is the woman who put forward the test to ensure that only people who were GOPers and Christians and had this theology could work in the Justice Department. It came out of this. So when I hear that the same university is trying to push the Democrats out, it becomes very easy to believe and accept. Am I wrong?
No, I would agree with you. I think the university is, you know, overstepping its bounds, to say the least, when it tries to tell students what they can and cannot. I mean, of course, there's going to be legitimate things where a university could say, could set parameters for what students are allowed to form a club around. But when you're talking about a political party and you're trying to shut down the other political party's freedom of speech, it's hard to put any legitimacy to that. Hopefully they'll be able to reach some type of compromise where they won't have to affiliate the university's name, but they will be able to have their club. And if they're not able to have their club, I would suggest they did the same thing as I've seen done at other universities where action that was questionable was taken against a group of students for their beliefs. You go out and solicit legal assistance, and often this will be given at no charge.
I agree.
It doesn't mean you have to get involved in a big, long, drawn-out lawsuit. Simply the threat, once the university realizes that they are on, you know, thin legal ice, that's not really something that could be supported, that will get their attention and get them to come around pretty quickly, usually.
Well, if the law would actually allow that to take place. So that's going to be very interesting to see. And listening to Jerry Falwell's rant against gay marriage and saying, or gays, and saying that they are the reason that 9/11 happened pretty much dismisses every other word that comes out of his mouth. But while we're on the subject of gays, let's shift over to the gay marriage debate, which is raging where you are in California right now.
Right.
The California Supreme Court, as we alluded to earlier, upheld Proposition 8, which is the voter initiative banning gay marriage. I will freely admit that I was stunned when I heard this. I was just stunned. I really believed that this was an initiative that was removing a right that pre-existed, and therefore it was a revision of the Constitution and not an amendment to the Constitution, which...
Well, I'm not going to pretend I have any great legal insight here, but the buzz was...
Apparently mine was wrong, so...
there was a lot of buzz on the Internet and on the in the media that this was what the expected outcome was. It pretty much came out exactly as predicted, that they did not
spout
marriage that were already happening.
That's a crock. Nobody was predicting this before that I know of. They're saying that now.
No. This was, I read this, like, for example, was repeated in Yahoo News that this was the expected outcome.
Well, I didn't
it was expected by the right. I don't think it was expected by the majority of Americans, and the ruling was actually 6-1, and the court said that the November ballot measure that restored the ban on same-sex marriage was a limited constitutional amendment.
Now, this is an interesting this is the interesting legal question, and I don't quite feel confident enough to say that this was the rule that they came up with, but it would appear at first glance that what California Supreme Court, and it's a liberal court, ruled was that the right to marry was not one that was pre-existing. Therefore, it was not a revision of the Constitution. Am I incorrect in that? Because if that's the case, it would then seem to be contradicted by the court saying, hey, we're going to allow all those that are married up until now to be married.
Well, they did not undo the marriages that California had, had carried out prior to the ruling. So it does create an interesting situation where I don't know if it was formally allowed or whatnot, but it came to be where the state was marrying people of the same sex, and then now we're going to stop, but we're not going to throw out the previous marriages. So it's.
But does that seem like a convoluted ruling?
Well, it wasn't a close ruling, so I have to imagine that there was something behind it, although I must admit I do not know the legal intricacies of this issue.
Well, the good thing about our show, ladies and gentlemen, is that we follow Glenn Beck's rules where facts don't really matter because we merely commentate on things. Therefore, as a commentator, we can pretty much say whatever the hell we damn well feel like it.
Excellent. I'm ready with my opinion, but when it comes to the specifics.
Chief Justice Ronald George wrote for the majority that Proposition 8, quote, carves out a narrow and limited exception to the state constitutional protection gays and lesbians now receive. And this is another quote, but I'm not exactly sure if it is his. The court majority said that same-sex couples would continue to have the right to choose life partners and enter into committed, officially recognized, and protected family relationships that enjoy all the benefits of marriage under the state's domestic partnership law. And here's my problem with that. I'm just going to say, flat out, separate is not necessarily equal.
Well, by definition, it's not.
Right, but that's what the court is basically handing gays and lesbians. Okay, you can't have the right to marry, you know, but you can have the right to, you know, to be life partners and be officially recognized and protected. That's baloney, because you know what? When you get a divorce, you don't go back to your reverend or, priest or religious person. You go to the court. And although you can marry in the court, you can also marry religious, by religious persons. And there's a differentiation there that the court is not acknowledging.
Well, we really have to ask ourselves then. This is not a particularly conservative or reactionary court. Well, why would if it seems cut and dried, why did the court end up with this decision, and why was it not a close?
Well, obviously it wasn't cut and dry. I mean, things are weren't that easy. Now it does. There is updated news on this, that Olson and Boies. Those two names might sound familiar to those who remember Bush v. Gore. These are the two that did the Bush v. Gore lawsuit.
Talk about the federal case.
Yes, they have filed a federal lawsuit in U.S. District Court in Northern California. And Chief Justice Vaughn Walker is a George W. Bush appointee, and actually came in from Reagan, and Bush reselected him. George H.W. Bush. They have filed a lawsuit stating that this law, Proposition 8, violates federal law, federal constitution, and there's constitutional issues on the federal side. Now, this is a this is going to be interesting because it really is if this goes through the federal courts and is taken, it could eventually, in theory, end up at the U.S. Supreme Court, which my guess is why Mr. Olson and Mr. Boies took the case in the first place.
Absolutely. And the 136.7-whatever-page majority decision actually went into detail about that, and they distinguished the California amendment from those of other states and the federal constitution, which is where most people that are involved in this foresee it going. It's going to go to the Supreme Court because this is a civil rights issue.
But this is a very, very high risk game. You got one bite at this apple, and you're going to go at it. They're going to be attacking DOMA is what they're attacking, which is the Defense of Marriage Act. And there has been no federal lawsuit up to date seeking to overturn state bans on gay marriage that I'm aware of. The issue here is that there are so many conservative federal judges out there that it is unlikely that there's going to be a ruling in favor of this. That is the overwhelming opinion, and frankly has a lot to do with why this case has not been brought before the federal courts up until now. So this is going to be a very dangerous thing. I think the ultimate goal is to shove this right into the Supreme Court. But it's going to be a very dangerous road because...
Yeah, it does have a lot of people worried. I had heard that in our local media, that jumping into the federal court, the people filing a lawsuit, this could go well or this could go completely the other way.
Well, keep in mind, this will end up in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which, let's be honest, if there's any circuit in the United States that's going to allow this to go through, it's going to be the Ninth. It's hands down, I believe it's undisputedly, the most liberal of all the circuits in the United States. However, where it goes after that is going to be interesting. Where the court, which is predominantly conservative, the Supreme Court, where that goes, we don't know where this new nominee, Sotomayor, stands on the issue and where they're going to go. And this could either make the gay rights issue and solidify a right that they believe they hold, or could this not shut the whole thing down?
This is yet another problem where it's nice as it is to let states decide their own destiny as much as possible. When you're talking about an issue like this, it really creates problems. You know, for example, I don't know if there was some type of loophole or whatnot, but if you get married in a traditional marriage in one state, other states have to recognize that marriage. You don't go get married in California and then you get married in Nevada and they're going to move to New York, you get married in New York. So if
well, you can, but that's not legal.
And we're in a current state right now where we have some states banning gay marriage and some states marrying gay couples. Doesn't this create a problem where we need a federal decision on this?
Well,
I think it's the problem is that some states are more progressive in their thinking than others because this is essentially an issue of equal protection for minority groups. Okay, you know, some people, granted, apparently a majority of them in California don't like gay couples with the idea of marrying. This is an issue of a power struggle and the ownership of the term marriage. Because if you can recognize that gays, you know, are legally
equal.
Right. Are legally equal for the purposes of everything else other than the term married, then
well,
What's the big deal?
This has been a conversation I've had several times with other people, is it seems to be we end up in the schoolyard. The idea that you're going to give a group every single right, which in a lot of cases they don't, but let's just for the sake of argument, every single person has the same exact right. Gays and straight have identical same rights, but one can't call it marriage is ridiculous. Now, there was a comment made on Bill Maher a couple of weeks ago, and I, for the life of me, I forgot who made it because I'd like to properly credit people, but I'll just steal his idea anyway. He said that this is ultimately a losing battle for the opponents of gay marriage. And it is, as he described it, a waste of time. And the reason it's a waste of time is because all civil rights actions in the United States eventually win. The idea that you're going to close the barn door now and you're going to ban gay marriage is not going to happen. I mean, even if it did, it would be temporary.
Yeah. Good.
Well, what I was going to say was if the outpouring that we saw after the election that ironically elected our first black president but quashed the rights of gays to get married, which is an irony that does not escape me at all. The outrage we saw after that would have been awesome if we could have seen that before then. Because had those people who marched on November 5th marched on November 3rd, the measure may not have passed. So this is another one of those things where being involved helps. However, it's obviously going to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court, which is going to challenge the entire legality of the Defense of Marriage Act, which is what Mike was just referring to, where one state has to recognize other states' marriage, the Defense of Marriage Act, which, by the way, stupid name for it, because if you want to defend marriage, you ban divorce. That's how you defend marriage. Let's just cut the nonsense here. They put this window dressing on. They act like marriage is under attack. It's not under attack because Steve and Joe want to get married. It's under attack because Senator Schmuckatelli over there is too busy diddling his secretary, and now he's got to get a divorce. But that's okay, because he was Speaker of the House, and now he's going to run for president. But I'm not naming names. Now, we will save our self-righteous indignation for Newt Gingrich. Damn, I did it. We'll save our self-righteous indignation for him later. But the idea of calling it Defense of Marriage, I find in and of itself offensive. Beyond that is that this law, to get to Mike's point, specifically exempted marriage involving gays from that equal protection clause of the Constitution.
I remember this now.
So what the constitutional issue of ultimately is going to be is that law in its of itself unconstitutional? My answer is, of course it is. But whether or not a conservative court will see that remains to be seen.
Well, I have a problem with the argument that this is that the right has predicated their argument on, and that is that, you know, marriage is between a man and a woman. Why? Their answer almost unanimously seems to be because it's for the purpose of procreation. That does not take into consideration the fact that there are many childless couples. And
well, it's a ridiculous statement. It is,
but it is one that is repeated again and again to the point of idiocy by Falwell, Robertson, Glenn Beck.
Well, come on. You're naming off a list of idiots.
You're right, but they have an audience. That's the problem. They have an audience who subscribes to everything that comes out of their mouths, and that is where you run into a problem because our country has eliminated almost all, you know, notions and laws that have discriminated against minority groups and have, you know, served to do nothing but put asunder certain, you know, groups as inferior. We did it, you know, with Catholics, Jews. We had issues with gender as far as women not being equal. And then we had it with blacks. This is just the next step.
It's important to note the same arguments that are being made to stop gays from marrying are the same arguments that are being made to stop interracial couples from marrying back in the 60s. But
no, I don't think so. Did they say back in the 60s that this was about procreation? And I think that...
Yes, they did. They said they didn't want to mix races. They most certainly did.
That's a different argument procreation or it's not for procreation. I think that you still have a significant portion of people in America that, although they don't want to, you know, they don't necessarily believe the religious extreme that this is a sin, that it's an abomination, but they are not comfortable with fully accepting it and embracing it. And I think that's what you're running into here. People get very uncomfortable when you're talking about the family's exposure to children and complete societal acceptance of the gay lifestyle. I think there's also a slight difference between this and you're calling them a minority group, but gay behavior, for lack of a different, you know, lack of a better term, spans across both genders and all racial groups. It's not exactly the same thing.
No, it's not the same thing, but nonetheless, you know, I think we've run this segment as far as we can, and we're going to do a very nice little hard shift here because I want to get on to
Hear that transmission crunch.
Yeah, we're going to grind the gears here.
Way to go with the smoothness there.
I've been accused of many things. Being smooth is not one of them. I want to talk about my second favorite guy out of Illinois. My first favorite guy out of Illinois is Rod Blagojevich. I love this guy. He
Are
is
gonna,
amazing. I love him.
You're
going to
be all alone on that island.
I don't think so. I think I'm going to get some converts here today. I love this guy because he is basically saying, I did nothing wrong. Now, the United States Attorney disagrees, and we'll see what happens with that. However, the infamous inflammatory charge that was made against Rod Blagojevich was that he was trying to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat. And we saw the U.S. attorney parade out last December the urgency of we've got to hurry up and let everyone know that he's trying to do this so that we can stop him from doing something that he's constitutionally allowed to do, which is appoint a senator. He ends up appointing my second favorite guy. My second favorite elected official from Illinois, Roland Burris. Now, Roland Burris is my second favorite official second favorite elected from Illinois, not because I like him as a person. I think the guy's putz. I think he's an eccentric putz. I think he's actually a bit of a disgrace to the people he's supposed to represent. But he's not there to represent me, so I don't have to care if he represents them or not. That's for the voters of Illinois to decide if he represents them properly or not. However, this nonsense about trying to sell a Senate seat, to me anyway, has exposed not what they're trying to say, which is Chicago politics as usual. I will go one step further. I will say this is exposing politics as usual on all levels across the board. Yes, I said it. I said it out loud. This is what goes on every single day. It's going on as we speak in city halls and diners and state houses across this country. What can you do for me and what can I do for you? And what is happening here is we are seeing this come out front page. I listened to these tapes of Roland Burris caught up in this. And first of all, who in the hell is releasing these tapes? Who is it that is strategically releasing out-of-context tapes for the purpose of politically assassinating someone? Because that's what they're doing. If you've got tapes on the guy, release the whole damn thing. Release it all so that we have the context of what was said, when, and how. However, the tapes that were released are showing a man who clearly wants a Senate seat. Clearly. However, He doesn't want to be accused of buying it. Clearly, he says it point blank on the tapes. I don't want it to look like I'm buying it. He then follows it up with, well, how can I help the governor? Now, not those exact words, I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist of it. And he wants to help the guy with donations or holding fundraisers or something that's going to be politically advantageous to Rod Blagojevich. Is this not what takes place every single day? What is lobbying? Why is it that a lobbyist will hold a $200,000 fundraiser for a congressman if it's not for he wants to get something through Congress? So for all you congressmen out there, Democrats, listen to me, Harry Reid, with your self-righteous indignation. Let's go down your list of contributors, shall we? Let's go down every single one of your list of contributors, Democrats, Republicans, all you guys that have the nerve to sit here and act like Roland Burris is the only one out there who ever did anything trying to get something for himself. Knock it off. You're all full of it. Anyone want to challenge me here on our panel today? I'd love to hear someone try. Come on, I'm ready for it.
I don't know that I have a challenge. It's just maybe a reflection of the thought here, but it is often a fine line between what is legal and yet seemingly not necessarily corrupt. If it's maybe something can be legal and corrupt as well, or something that is completely illegal. For example, if I come up to you and I throw a fundraiser. And often you'll see the same lobbyists, big corporations, they'll throw fundraisers for both sides. That way they can't lose. And to think that they hold that fundraiser and they have those lobbyists and they make that support and they don't get anything from it for it is ridiculous. Of course they get something for it. But then if you go directly to somebody and say, I will give you X amount of dollars to vote this way on such and such a bill, that would be completely illegal. So it does show that they've managed to legally get the corruption into the system. And weeks ago, I know we were on the topic of such things as state-funded campaigns and taking the money out of the system. But I don't think you can get rid of any of this until you take the money out of the system. As much as I don't like to see government run these types of things, as much as I can agree with people who say your ability to donate, your ability to have fundraisers is an expression of free speech, I don't see how you get this kind of leveraging corruption out of the system without taking the money out of it.
Well, you are 100% right. And there are clean money campaigns going on throughout the entire country where they're trying to push to get what they call clean money, which is basically voter-funded campaigns, voter-funded elections. Now, of course, the spin for that is, you know, you don't want this. Well, actually, you probably do. It would cost a lot less. It would stop these ridiculous negative ads constantly. They have to run positive ads, fact-based ads. You'd actually start educating your constituents. Now, the people in power want nothing to do with this. Nothing to do with this at all.
This is got them into power.
I think that Illinois deserves an award for transparency because they've had a history of political corruption throughout, and this is just. I mean, not that I'm defending him because I think that he's deserving of everything that's coming to him, but they're hanging him out to dry as Burris because this is business as usual and money talks, and the defense of that is always selective memory. And Blago is the perfect representation of that because his defense is always, who, me? You know, he compares himself to the Pope and the Dalai Lama and Jesus as if he is perfect and above reproach, and he uses other people, you know, as his scapegoats, and it's bad.
But the reason why I love this guy is because he's basically giving the finger to everybody, saying, you know, to heck with you guys, I'm doing the same thing you're doing every single day. You're trying to make it illegal for me because – and maybe he did cross the line, but I find it very interesting. He's not been charged with anything relating to the supposed selling of Barack Obama's Senate seat, which anyone who remembers that was the big thing. That was the, oh, my God, he's trying to do what? That was the outrageous thing that he supposedly had done, not been charged with anything relating to that. Now we're seeing what I deem to be strategic leaks of Roland Burr's caught up on federal wiretaps. If this is coming out of the prosecutor's office voluntarily, it is completely unprofessional. If this is coming, wherever this is coming from, it's a political hit. It's designed to be a political hit. Now you got Harry Reid, who is saying that they're not going to support a sitting Democrat in the seat, which they are duty bound to do. They're not going to support it. So the guy's got about $700 sitting in his campaign war chest right now. The Democrats are screwing the pooch so bad they're liable to cede the seat to the Republicans, giving up the advantage they have in the Senate. To do what? To make themselves look good? Like we don't know they're all a bunch of corrupt fools? Because they are.
The federal judge said that they would allow the U.S. Senate Ethics Committee to have a federal wiretap of Blagojevich's brother having the conversation with now U.S. Senator Roland Burr. And the Senate Ethics Committee has already begun their preliminary investigation.
And that's where these wiretaps are coming out.
Right, to determine if there were perjury charges that need to be filed.
The Senate Ethics Committee has got no business dealing with whether or not perjury charges should be filed against Roland Burr back in Illinois. And the issue for those listeners who are listening to this is very simple, and that is that the Roland Burr said in testimony that he did not have conversations with people regarding with Blagojevich or his people regarding the Senate seat. The backup to that was that after he left, after he gave his testimony and left, he sent in multiple affidavits that that he changed his mind, that he was changing his testimony to indicate that he had several conversations. Now, whether or not that amounts to perjury, I don't know. In most cases, you are permitted to change your testimony relatively quickly as long as you correct it with the body that is being done. If you go to the jury, in front of a jury, and you testify incorrectly, and then you come back the next day and you clarify your testimony and you recall differently or whatever, however you want to craftily word it, the reality is, if you left and said, oh my God, I'm going to get caught, I need to fix this, you're given the opportunity to go back and fix it. So whether or not this would rise to perjury, I don't know. I'm almost willing to bet you it wouldn't, because they're politically attacking this guy.
Yeah, you have to wonder why this guy got singled out. I mean, obviously something was going on for them to go and I'm not saying that this means that he's guilty. But something had to be going on for them to tap the phone in the first place.
Blagojevich, they knew. In fact, Blagojevich even acknowledged to reporters in a public forum that, hey, if you want, and this is not a direct quote, but this is essentially what he said, that, you know, hey, I welcome you, you know, to come you know, listen to me or follow me, whatever. I actually should get the direct quote, but it points to his mentality there. And I think this is all.
I remember that. I remember him saying that he welcomes this type of scrutiny.
Right. I think this case, what we're dealing with now, as far as Burris and Blagojevich's brother, they want someone to scapegoat, because there was public outrage, you know, with Blagojevich from the get-go. As soon as
over the allegations of buying Barack Obama's
right.
sexy.
Right.
And this is about an appearance of seeming impropriety, because everyone wants to have that unblemished, you know, appearance that their hands are clean, so that their election or nomination appointment, as the case may be with Burris's situation, that their power is unchallenged. They want to look like, hey, I'm just the best, most wonderful guy for this nomination.
Well, going back to Jim's point, when they don't have any charges to press, it does reek of scapegoating. And I mean, is this Is this all due to the fact that they made this original allegation and then they feel that because we made these charges against this guy that we have to take further action or we'll be seen as not enforcing the law? What led to those original charges in the first place? You kind of wonder what the backstory is.
Well, to me,
is there something behind it? Does he have dirty hands?
Well, people, look, Blago's hands are not clean, but neither are any politician's hands clean. I mean, it's very difficult to have clean hands when you're involved in politics. It's very, very difficult.
But Blago is the one who has been the most outspoken. He's presented himself as what you said before, with this righteous indignation that, you know, they are just trying to railroad me. And so if he's saying that over and over again, and he went on his own self-initiated press tour to every single talk show in America to exonerate himself. And so if they let him say this again and again, it's one of those, you know, repeat it enough and people will eventually take it as the truth. If they don't do something, and granted the trial is coming up, but if they don't do something to say, yes, you know, these allegations were deserving, there is something here that, you know, then it looks like he was right.
Yeah, if they don't press charges, it does look like he's right. You know, is he just the first mole that popped out in whack-a-mole?
Well, this is a very simple thing. If you got audio tapes that say that he's trying to sell a Senate seat, then this should not be we've got this and he's trying to do that. This should be we're filing these charges and here's the indictment. This is not some type of we have to do detective work. You claim to have the evidence. You claim that he bought the Senate seat or tried to buy the Senate seat. Now the Senate is trying to extend what they claimed back in early January, that whoever Rod Blagojevich appointed was going to be tainted by this. They're only going to be tainted because all these guys are making a big deal out of it, not because of any legitimate tainting. Now, could that change? Sure, it's possible that could change. However, right now, from what I've seen, and I don't see any chance of more evidence coming in, so either you've got the case to make or you don't and you go away. But in typical political attacks, the way a political attack works, it's not about facts. It's like a Glenn Beck TV show. It's not about facts. It is about being able to make someone appear to be guilty by, in last week's special comment, I made a comment about leading someone down a road to a destination. This is an old style political attack, and what it does is, I'll set it up with Barack Obama, okay? This happened to Barack during the campaign. You hear Barack Obama was a secret Muslim. Barack Obama pals around with terrorists. Barack Obama, his middle name is Hussein. He wasn't born in the United States. There's a conspiracy around his birth certificate. And then they bring up the whole socialist, terrorist, Hussein, Muslim. Well, what are they doing? They're driving you down a road that has only one destination. He's a terrorist. However, they're not stupid enough to say that. So what they're doing is they're hoping you are stupid enough to believe that. And they're giving you only evidence that leads to one conclusion. You know, if you listen to the rantings of that nutcase, Sarah Palin from Alaska, you would believe that on day one, Barack Obama was going to hand over the nuclear launch codes to Iran. That's what they were basically saying.
From her backyard, probably.
He pals around with terrorists. It was an idiotic statement to make, but it brought you to only one destination. What they're saying now with Roland Burris and with Blago before him is, you know, he's corrupt. He's trying to buy it. Oh, here's this little drip, 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 drip. And they're leading you to have only one destination in mind, which is that he bought the seat or did something illegal to get the seat. Well, if you did something illegal to get the seat, then go in front of a jury and make your case. Go ahead and make your point.
BBS Radio.
com. Said, oops, well, you know, I actually did have, I actually did talk to Blagojevich's people, and he has already said on the record that he has been asked to help raise campaign money for him, and so Burris looks guilty, and they can't just let that go. They can't give him a free pass on that. It's like, first you say you didn't, that now you, you know, have this affidavit that says that where you admit that you have.
It does seem very, very strange. I mean, we have to. Well, the thing is, but he had the right to do that, and we don't get to predetermine whether or not he was guilty or not. But what they're doing right now is a political attack instead of going in front of a jury where he's supposed to do.
I agree with you that they're doing political attacks, but the difference between the normal political attack ad and this is that there has been action against Blagojevich that, you know, be it right or wrong, it gives credence to their argument. Like, if you get arrested for a crime, for example, that doesn't mean you committed it, but I can run around in the street going, oh, look, he got arrested for such and such a crime.
Oh, and if you got indicted for a crime, it doesn't mean you committed it.
Oh, I can use that as and I can create the idea that you're guilty.
Guys, we got a hard break coming here, so we're going to have to cut this one short. It's a great lively discussion. I'm going to bring this guy back again because I love this guy. Did I mention that I love this guy?
Yeah, are you going to buy his hair care product? The volumizing shampoo.
You know what?
I'm a hot seller.
I'm not even going to have a conversation about hair care. I had a bad experience this week. We're taking a hard break, guys. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Have you added up all the hidden costs behind Walmart's prices? The estimated $1.8 billion taxpayers shell out for health care because Walmart doesn't cover their employees. The lost wages of 1.6 million women who had to take Walmart to court to get paid the same as men. The countless manufacturing jobs lost while America's largest corporation became America's biggest importer of Chinese goods. Behind Walmart's profits, the middle class pays the price. America can't afford it any longer.
Welcome to my tweet. It's me, Gotta Laugh, from the Political Carnival blog, and here I am to recap the week in politics via Twitter. This episode of My Tweet Spot is brought to you by Proposition 8. Hate gays who consummate? Support Prop 8. Liberal chick was on a roll. She tweeted, "Now California needs to outlaw divorce because it's damaging to the fiber of traditional hetero marriage. People who can get married, convicts, felons, deadbeat parents, child abusers, drug addicts, but not gays, Sinfonian said, "I blame Miss California." You know, Sinfonian, I do too, especially because Donald Trump and his hair liked her so much. Teresa Kopeck said, "Odd, my marriage doesn't feel any stronger than it did this morning." To which Anna Marie Cox replied, "But I'm a lot more smug about it." Martin Schechter said, "If any prop can create an exception to equal protection, there is no equal protection." J.C. Christian tweeted, "If marriage equality laws included mandatory firearms ownership provisions, love segregation would not exist." Lee Stranahan. Broken news. Obama and eBay propose cap-and-trade-like system for California, allowing same-sex couples to sell existing marriage licenses. Reiking was on a roll. Inspired by Prop 8, Florida's majority of Protestants ban Roman Catholicism statewide with a ballot initiative. Inspired by Prop 8, Wyoming ballot initiative results in forced relocation of non-white minorities to other states. Inspired by Prop 8, Mormon ballot initiative bans monogamous marriage and institutes compulsory polygamy in Utah. Inspired by Prop 8, George Soros funds multi-state initiative in states Obama won, gets GOP banned. And during all the heated back-and-forth tweets about marriage equality, Meghan McCain tweets, "Song of the day, Satan said dance by clap your hands, say yeah." This just in, bonus Meghan McCain tweet. Just got a speeding ticket on the way to the doctor. Don't worry, dear. Mommy and Daddy will take care of it. Back to you, Jim.
Well, Meghan McCain's not the only one who got a speeding ticket. I managed to give my donation to the state of New York as well. So got a $165 check on its way to them, so tell me that doesn't bite. 1-888-228-4494, 888-228-4494 is our number. At Jim Alger is us on Twitter. Twitter. Why do I say Twitter? I don't know. The subject we're going to go on to right now is the GM impending bankruptcy. I'm just not with it this afternoon. The GM impending a bankruptcy, as well as the economy overall. This is a mixed bag of news regarding the economy. And we've got some good news. We've got some bad news. And here to discuss all of the above with us is Katie Craig, my esteemed colleague and economic expert, who is here to join us today. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How are you today?
Fantastic. How are you doing, Jim?
I'm doing good. If I can get around our mandatory technical issues, we did get knocked off the air about 15 seconds there. Sorry, folks, a bit of a server problem. Our show would not be our show without a technical issue a week. That's kind of our motto here.
Hey, 15 seconds is good. I don't knock it.
No, that was pretty good. So, Katie, you got some stuff to tell us about GM and bankruptcy, and we're freaking out because, oh, my God, GM's going to fail and the whole economy is going to tank and save me. What do you got for us?
Okay, well, first of all I can say is there's no need to worry that much about everything. My biggest issue right now is just the speed of things. You know, GM's come out and they're holding a midday conference in the GM building in New York on Monday, and that's supposed to be the day that our 100-year-old automaker and the kind of a heart of America is going to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Now, I know that this comes as a big, you know, distress to a lot of people in the American public because filing for bankruptcy has such a negative connotation, but there's something to understand about filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. It's really more of a restructuring rather than just the company's going to liquidate and never going to be GM again. So the government's expected to take on about 72.5% of the company's assets to restructure and help refund and to get them out of the bankruptcy and to put it back in the hands of the American people. So it's not as bad as everything looks. I mean, GM's lost nearly $90 billion since 2005. And so this is just, it's been pending for such a long time, and everybody's kind of figured that it was coming. So it's happening on Monday. But the biggest problem that I have with everything right now is the bondholders that have about $28 billion in stake in the company, which my heart goes out to them. I mean, everybody's losing a lot of money on this thing, but they're refusing to settle with the deal that they've gotten from the government for the bankruptcy when they go to court. And this is going to happen anyway. Everybody's lost so much money. And if you don't settle now and you don't get them through the bankruptcy, which the government could do better than the company could do, obviously, with the state that they're in right now, then so many more people are going to lose so much more money and never get their jobs back.
Right.
So my...
This is Mike here. I've got a couple of questions for you, Katie, on the issue of GM's bankruptcy. From what I hear, that, you know, a lot of people, like you were saying, hear bankruptcy and think, oh my God, the company's gone. But, you know, as we know, that's not true. From what I understand, Chrysler went into bankruptcy and the sales actually blipped up a little bit for the sale of their cars. What concerns me is these other things that I hear about. If GM goes bankrupt and restructures the debt, this means a lot of people are going to get cut out of a lot of money. You know, for example, people get their health care from General Motors, people that get their pensions from General Motors. What happens to those people?
Okay, well, definitely. I mean, the people that have a stake in the company and all of these employees, I mean, the employees are losing their jobs. And as I understand it, and the figures you read everywhere are different, but from what I've understood and what I've compiled myself is that over 90% of what the bondholders have had invested in GM, they're losing. And which is why they're holding out for a deal, because they're looking at it and they're going, oh my God, like, I'm getting less than 10% of what I had invested in this company.
Wow.
So, you know, a lot of them, they're not going to see this money again. But
I've heard that. Go ahead. What I was saying is that I've heard that if this goes through, that bondholders, of course, are going to lose a lot of money, but that it will be a total loss for stockholders. Is that true? Is it?
You know, they have a deal to where they can get, like, they can buy up to a certain percent of their stock back afterwards, like after the restructuring. But, I mean, as it stands, they're not going to get this money. And that's just how Chapter 11 bankruptcy works. It's how most bankruptcy works. I mean, it's the name of the game. The company's going under. The money's not there. The government's already given, you know, $20 billion, and they're offering another $30 billion just to get the company through this bankruptcy. So basically, the people that hold stock and the people that hold bonds and the Chapter 11 bankruptcy in GM and Chrysler as well, they're called debtor in possession. And basically, it just means that they possess the debt, so when the company can restructure it to where the debt becomes an asset or, you know, some kind of money that's not debt, the debt repayment plan is going to be developed through a credit counseling. So they're going to have to file into the court systems to get certificate of credit counseling so that they can get, like, their evidence of payment and get any money back whatsoever. But that's going to come when we find out how long this is going to take and if the company's going to rebound, too. But, I mean, as it stands right now, they're not really going to get much of their money back whatsoever.
They're looking at pennies on the dollar, the people that own, that have interest in GM, then, whether they be shareholders or bondholders. Is that what you're saying?
They're looking at fractures of pennies on the dollar as far as it stands now.
This is like a stock market collapse to them.
Right, and that's why so many of the bondholders and the people that hold stock in this company are not willing to accept the deals that they've been given, because the deals that they've been given, you look at it and say, that's not a deal, you're just screwing me right now. And so, I mean, this is not to sprinkle ashes on their head and dance around and say, yeah, okay, too bad for you, so sad. But what I'm saying is, if you don't settle now and the company can't get the deal in court when it goes to file, because, you know, the court's going to have a final say in everything that happens on Monday, but if they don't come up with some kind of deal and get this ball rolling and get some kind of proactive action and get the government in there and the government to restructure, the company will never come back. And the little money that they're seeing right now, they probably won't even be able to get that if they don't settle for it. So GM, I've read in several articles online, just been reading about the latest news, because this has really been happening in the past couple of days, that they're saying, you know, if you don't accept this deal by Saturday, that they're going to have to go in and rechange everything or liquidate, or, you know, there's all different kinds of plans for now. But as it stands now, they're going to plan or file their plan under Section 363 of the Chapter 11 Bankruptcy Code.
Looking at the larger effect, so we have a situation in which, of course, people that have direct interest in GM are going to be affected greatly, the bondholders, the shareholders, the employees. What about the effect on the larger economy as a whole, GM being such a large employer and quite a large player for a long time in our economy? Then they're going to restructure. Obviously, they don't have the income they used to. They're not paying out money to employees, to shareholders like they used to. What type of ripple effect do you expect, or have we already felt this in the economy as a whole?
You know, that feeds into why I think that speed is of the utmost importance, because, like you're saying, there's so many people that hold stock, have bonds, were employed by GM and directly affected by this, that they're not going to be going out and they're not going to go to McDonald's to get their hamburger. And then, you know, McDonald's is going to have to lay people off, and they're not going to go to the mall to buy their jeans. And then, you know, PacSun is, you know what I'm saying? So
yeah, exactly.
Basically, an economy, and especially the United States economy, which is the, you know, free market that we have, everybody's going to be affected by this. When that amount of people lose their jobs, they're not pumping money back into the economy, which is why I'm just kind of urging the bondholders and, you know, everybody that's involved with this to really just start taking action as quickly as they can after the company files on Monday, just because it could have potentially such a negative effect on the economy as a whole. And, you know, again, it's awful. And at this point, it's kind of like you got to cut your losses. I mean,
so
my house is down, and I'm on the second floor of my house, and I'm thinking, okay, I could grab as much stuff from the second floor of my house and then run downstairs and try to get as much stuff from the first floor of my house and see if I make it out alive, or I could just get out of the house and then be alive to build myself a new house. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's, at some point, you have to say, this is happening, this is imminent, let's deal with it and get it back on the road again to where it's not going to have such a tanking effect.
Right, so damage has pretty much been done, and our best course of action, from what I'm hearing you're saying, is get through this and restructure this company as quickly as possible. Would that be correct?
Exactly.
Well, my question here is, you know, this goes in front of a bankruptcy judge. The judge doesn't have to go with the program. The judge could do something completely different. So what is guaranteeing? I mean, are they buying a judge? I mean, how is this gonna work?
You know, that's a very good question. I guess all I could tell you is
I gotta have fun a show.
You do. Jim, I think you have plenty more than one a show. All I can tell you is that the government and all the people that have been working on this to come up with some kind of plan as far as exactly how this restructuring in Chapter 11 is going to work are trusted by the court system. So if everybody comes to court and the bondholders come to court and say, I accept this and such, and, you know, et cetera, then the court is going to rule in favor of the plan as it now stands. The restructuring plan as it stands. So, I mean, this bankruptcy is going to be the fourth largest in United States history and the largest industrial filing ever. So, I mean, the people that have been working on this have been working day and night to find all the money that they can and get all the
people. She needs the code.
That they can on board. And if they do that, then the judge will be in favor of it.
Right. And,
no, okay. Go ahead, Mike.
I had one last question for you. Being as that most of what I know about the economy is just what I read in headlines and in the paper, I've heard a lot recently of signs of a turnaround, and then I'm contrasting that to, you know, continued home price decline and, you know, now this news of GM facing imminent bankruptcy. Can you tell us what are the areas in which people are seeing this so-called turnaround, and do you believe that at this point we are coming out of the recession, or is GM hitting this bankruptcy, meaning we're going further in, or is this just pretty much what led us here in the first place?
You know, I would say that there are some great signs that we are coming out of the recession. And, you know, I mean, we're definitely not going to be there by December of this year, but signs in the housing market, housing inventories are lowering nationwide and slowly, very slowly, but they are. And so that's definitely encouraging, because a lot of this economic crisis was on the shoulders of the housing market, you know, and
right.
All that Freddie Mac junk that happened. And so with that on the turnaround, that's very, very encouraging for the economy, just because it's boosting consumer confidence. It's showing that people aren't worried to get out there and put money down on a home again, which nobody was doing whatsoever. And with all this happening with GM, I mean, it could have a very negative connotation on the economy in general. However, if we keep reminding the American public that, you know, these warranties are backed by the government, and, you know, the cars aren't going to be unsafe to buy. You know, I mean, there's going to be the warranties. Every car that's already got a warranty on it, and all the insurance and everything that people have already, is backed by the government. And this isn't like GM's just completely going under and they're starting from the bottom up and they're going to redo everything. They're going to redo everything in the company. What it's just doing is it's taking the debt that they have now, and then the government's going to go in, put as much money in federal aid as they can, which is already $19.4 billion right now, and they're going to get an estimated $30 billion, I believe. And then they're going to put it back in the hands of the American people. So the company's still there. The cars are still there to be bought. If people would start buying American, you know, they wouldn't have to worry about their economy. And it's funny, because they're too worried about their economy to buy American. which would be a great solution to their economy.
It's kind of sad the way it tends to go into a tailspin. People hear that news and they're very hesitant to spend. They kind of hold their breath. And we've seen that, you know, this huge backing down off of buying automobiles, more than you would even expect to be justified. But I take it from what you're saying that it's of course the company's going to be a continuing concern and it's not going to go away. The government's going to save it, and that people should not have that worry about buying a new vehicle.
Right, right. I mean, 67% roughly of all General Motors cars and trucks that are sold in the United States are built domestically. So the new plan is going to boost that level of cars that are built domestically beyond 70% by the year 2013. That's something that the company's released as part of their restructuring plan, which is such great news for our economy. I mean, as far as when these companies get put back into the American people's hands and plants that are still open and up and running, this is going to be wonderful job creation. I mean, they're going to close about 14 plants as part of the Ford restructuring plan. But when they open back up, they're going to open up even more. And more of these cars, more of these trucks are going to be built domestically. More people here are going to have jobs. And it's great. Not only are they going to have more plants and are going to build more cars here, but they're going to do the whole energy efficiency thing. So,
Do you think we'll see a release of pent-up demand? Like, if people have been waiting so long, if they finally see signs of things turning around, maybe there'll be a period of time in which a lot more cars than usual are being bought. We could see a snapback.
Oh, for sure. I think that that's really what's going on with the housing market right now, because prices are so low for homes and condos that when the consumer confidence, which has been gradually rising and inventory is lowering as far as the housing market is concerned, people are saying this is a wonderful time for me to buy a house because, you know, it's less expensive. There's a new tax incentive, the $8,000 tax incentive from the federal government, which they're going to give incentives like that for cars to help lower the car inventories. And people are going to go out there and they're going to buy the new cars. I mean, it's going to be a buyer's market. The cars aren't going to be as expensive, and they're still going to come with all the perks that the more expensive cars once did, and then the economy is going to be on the upturn. So, you know, I mean, there's always fluctuations in markets and in the economy in general. So fluctuations like this are not something to worry about. Part of the reason, and I mean, I tell people all the time, the economy is two-thirds numbers and one-third in people's heads. And when people get really worried and they hear these things like bankruptcy, I don't even like calling it bankruptcy. I call it restructuring because, you know, there's nothing that's bankruptcy about. I mean, Chapter 7, if they were filing Chapter 7, they would liquidate all the company's assets and get it out there and restart from scratch. But they're keeping GM the way that it is. They're keeping everything the way that it is. And they're going to close some plants, reopen more by 2013. And they're doing wonderful things with the company through the federal government's hands. And, you know, it's a real mess right now. And this is not me making light of the situation because I fully understand what this means for the company and for all the workers and everybody who holds stakes in the company. But it could be a really, really wonderful thing within the next 10 years for our economy and for the company and for all these people who lost their jobs. Well, you know, they could conceivably, if they didn't find another one, have their job back, and then more jobs will be created out of this. So there's going to be new, stricter fuel efficiency requirements for all the nation's cars and trucks. So, I mean, there's like a fleet-wide average of 35.5 miles per gallon.
That's going to be managed
by 2016.
It sounds like they're really getting things to where they should have been a long time ago. And you know, because we talked about this, that I personally think that some of this has to do with the whole boogeyman syndrome that we started with our dear, wonderful Congress, who was trying to justify bailing out banks and not bailing out auto workers, and making this all unions' fault and saying that mean, evil car companies can't make good cars and it's all their fault and they're all going to be bankrupt anyway. And then, of course, what happens right after the Senate says this is what the fragile vehicle market that already existed just tanked. So you can draw a line from when the Senate hearings were to their the already low numbers and is falling off a cliff, because who's going to buy a car from a company that we think is going to be bankrupt? Now we're seeing that GM's going to go through Chapter 11, which, as you said correctly, is a reorganization, not so much a bankruptcy. They are trying to get rid of Hummer, good luck, guys, as well as Saturn, good luck, guys. The UAW a few hours ago reported they accepted more cuts to be able to go forward with this. The bondholders, of course, are going to get screwed. Everyone, this is a crap sandwich, and everyone's going to take a bite. But we do need to understand that a lot of this was, was our doing, and we need to fundamentally change how we do things. We bought these big trucks and cars. We wanted the gas guzzlers. It was big and bad, and I love my truck. You know, look at the commercials. It was, hey, I'm going to drive a pickup truck that can carry 10 other pickup trucks up a hill. Why? You know, and it was that. And if you drove a small economy car, you were just, oh, boogie, woogie, woogie. Well, now we're all trying to hear through the entire thing, and we're trying to see what we're going to do now as a country, and are we going to take ownership in where we go as a country. Now, in interesting economic news, we have the U.S. Government has revised their January to March numbers for the shrinkage of the U.S. economy, and it went from 6.1%, which is where they thought it was last month. It's down to 5.7. So not a big deal, but it is lower than what they originally thought. This is more news, more a positive sign that the worst appears, I say cautiously, to be behind us. With us being able to see, I've held for a long time that the GM and the auto industry was the linchpin of the entire thing. That the one thing could just, you know, topple this entire apple cart was if GM went into an unorganized liquidation and were toast. Then you talk about millions of jobs being lost. As of now it stands, there's about 30,000 jobs that are going to be cut through this entire process. So, I mean, there's still more pain to come, but it does seem to be decelerating.
And you know, if you're talking about the I love my big truck, I love my Escalade and my Hummer, next year GM's planning to debut two small fuel-efficient cars, the Chevrolet Volt and the Chevrolet Cruze, and they're going to get about 40 miles per gallon. So, I mean, this company's still going to do wonderful things, you know, and they're working through it.
Yeah, it seems like it, but it's a shame that it took this to get it through.
Yeah, it seems like we're going in the right direction now as far as let's look at different technology. Let's look at resizing the automobile and of having different consumer expectations. And from what I understand, the companies have been given not only bailout money but also additional money in order to develop these new technologies. But it sure was a violent way to get there.
I mean, I don't know if you guys remember ever hearing anything about this, but in 2005, I believe there were tons of questions about whether or not GM was going to file for bankruptcy. And, I mean, there was this whole bankruptcy scare that they had just 4 years ago. And they came out and they said, you know, it's not necessary at this point, but their company was already starting on the plunge then. So this has been kind of a long time in the making.
Long time coming. Ford kind of caught themselves, you know, but before this major fallout occurred, I know there was a change in the CEO of Ford, and he started changing the corporate plan and selling off assets and that allowed them to avoid a certain amount of this, but this has been a long time in the making.
Right. It really has.
And what protections do we have with GM as far as, you know, not outsourcing? There's been some talk out there that they are taking our bailout money and outsourcing jobs overseas, and you just said just the opposite. So,
That information, about job cuts and outsourcing overseas and everything like that, I mean, that's been some back chatter for a couple weeks now. But as far as I've read in the plan, I mean, they're closing down, like I said, they've already got plans to close down 14 plants. And so that's all that I've heard about the jobs as far as that's concerned and a solidified plan. I mean, they've been restructuring this plan and, oh, we're not going to file for bankruptcy. We're not going to use this plan. Oh, we're not going to do that. And they've been in cohorts with the bondholders and the government for quite some time now. But as far as the new Chapter 11 bankruptcy plan stands, I mean, like you said, tons of people are going to lose their jobs. Whether or not they outsource the jobs, there will be job creation within the next 4 years.
Well, here is the exact quote out of the article. It says, GM plans to import its own China-made cars beginning in 2011, which would make it the first major automaker to import Chinese cars to the U.S. market. GM is planning to sell around 17,000 China-made vehicles in the U.S. starting in 2011. It hopes to triple that number to 51,000 by 2014. Goes on to state, even with the sales of 51,000 vehicles annually, this will account for only about 1.6% of GM's estimated 3.1 million total sales. So it's not a lot of cars they're bringing in, but this is kicking open a very troubling door.
Well, you know,
I mean, within a week, GM's got another $4 billion, and so that makes their total bailout loan $19.4 billion, and that doesn't include the Canadian taxpayer money that was given to them. They're already heading toward bankruptcy, but supposedly the bankruptcy is just like has been a showdown, like I said, with the GM bondholders and the investors, and they're saying the company is planning to offshore, outsource all the jobs, and that they've already stated their intent to offshore, outsource 98% of production as part of their restructuring plan. But, you know, I mean, this has been a lot of speculation, but I haven't heard any comments from anybody within the company or, like, a credible source in the government that says we are, in fact, protecting these jobs or we aren't protecting these jobs. But, I mean, if they're going to outsource the jobs, it's not going to be, like you said, you know, hundreds of thousands of them.
Yeah, well, we should really work on making sure that we don't outsource jobs, especially in this type of economy. I do want to shift off of the GM thing onto another economic Armageddon that took place in the last week and a half, and that is the state of California, which just seems to have nothing but bad news. If there's any recovery taking place, I'll tell you where it's not happening. That's out in California, where they are now looking at closing 220 of their 270 state parks.
220 of 279.
And this now, I have to ask this question, Mike, and this is going to be pure speculation, but I have to ask this question. How much of what we're seeing out of the governor's office in California is punitive? Is you voters didn't give me what I want, so I'm going to find the places to cut, the most painful places I can find, and I'm going to stick the knife in. So we're going to cut education, parks, you know, right for the summer. We're going to cut the parks. We're going to cut out college grants. We're going to hurt your kids. We're going to hurt your parks. We're going to hurt your family. This is almost what it sounds like.
Well, I mean, where could they cut it where it wouldn't hurt? You're talking about state-run programs. That this is the type of things that are major parts of their budget. Education is, I believe, one of the largest, if not the largest, single expense that the state has.
It just seems to me like where they are choosing to go, and this could be completely naive of me. I freely admit this. Give me my Glenn Beck pass. This
I couldn't blame you.
This just seems to, you know, we've heard this before. Having been in Los Angeles, and my Los Angeles City Council members will love me for saying this, those lying SOBs tell us every time they want more money that it's going to be Armageddon. And that's got a lot to do with why the voters voted this down last week. They are so tired of hearing cops and firefighters incessantly. And, of course, they did that again this time around. And, by the way, guys, what's not being cut? Cops and firefighters. So
right.
I'm just trying to figure out what is, you know, what is really going on here. Is
you know,
this truly?
I hear what you're saying, and you know what I think there's a little bit of in here, and tell me if you agree. There's a little bit of Boy Who Cried Wolf. They've been screaming this every year since 2001, and I think we're all getting tired of it. On the other hand, this is the real deal. This is not politicians going, oh, my God, oh, my God. I mean, we are, the state literally doesn't have the money, and the way they've done it in the past is to borrow. They've already borrowed up to the hilt. And now we're looking at all sorts of interesting things. I'll give you a couple of things that have been going on here. They've just announced they're going to close down summer school. They don't have the money for that. They're talking about closing parks. I mean, we're talking major state parks, everything from Emerald Bay and Lake Tahoe to the sports arena they want to sell. And then they're threatening further cuts well beyond that.
The people in California. And for all of my listeners in California, listen very carefully because I really mean this. You guys should collectively rise up and demand that every single state legislator turn in their car right now. Sell it right now.
Public transportation.
Turn in your credit card right now. Because if this was your household, ladies and gentlemen, that's what you would have to do. They took an 18% pay cut. Oh, that's really nice. Make it 50%. We'll have a conversation.
Over 60,000 more jobs were lost in the job market just last month. About that Friday.
Let's keep this in mind, folks. General Motors president and CEO took a trip to the White House and was given his walking papers in no uncertain terms. Congressmen were screaming for their heads because, and I quote, anyone who can run a company into the ground as desperately as they have is not worthy of having that job. Well, how ironic.
What's good for the goose?
What's good for the goose,
I had a little
friend,
AIG
it's
back there.
Time for heads to roll. I think that Californians would really feel a lot better if they saw the legislature and the governor and the state officials and their city council members, Mr. I'm making $178,000 a year working for the L.A. City Council, and their city council members, they see these fat cats, and that's what you guys are.
Well, what do you think about
yourselves?
What do you think about the voters who voted that they want to see the budget gap closed with spending cuts and not tax increases?
First of all, I think there's two things going on here. One, you've got the voters who want everything and don't want to pay for it. That's
exactly
that's clearly true. But you also have the most ridiculously written ballot propositions, and then you're bombarded with deceptive advertising, which should all be banned.
Definitely.
All this crap should be banned. I mean, we really need – they're talking about a constitutional convention in California. I'm fighting for it. I support it. And while you're at it, change this proposition nonsense. By the way, for all you guys who think that democracy is such a great thing, look at California. California is run by ballot proposition, and this is what happens when you let the kids run the school.
Yeah, just to fill in the listeners here, we have continuous ballot initiatives in California, and there's separate issues here. There's the issue you are talking about. A lot of them are labeled in a misleading way. For example, the initiative about reducing tax from 10% to 9% when that tax was going to age out and go away. So you're actually replacing zero with 9%. So that's deceptively labeled proposition. They've done the same thing for term limits. Then you're talking about propositions that are not labeled in a deceptive manner. They sound great. Let's take out a bond measure for schools. Let's take out a bond measure for the elderly. Let's take out a bond measure. Things we would all agree sound great. So we voted those propositions in. Money was borrowed to pay for that. And there's not the money to continue it. Then the latest set of ballots that was just shot down for the most
part.
Which,
by the way, is the same exact thing, the same exact mentality that got people into these no-interest loans or this interest-only loans for their houses, is let's get this now with no long-term plan.
The people don't understand that these are basically unfunded mandates. They don't understand that. They say we're voting for schools, that's a good thing, and they're taking that power away from the legislature. And in addition to that, you have the legislature tied up with this rule that two-thirds of them have to vote in a new tax increase. Back to the things on the proposition on the ballot, a lot of the propositions that we just had that were kind of put up as an emergency response to this financial crisis were to undo some of the propositions in the past, to take away those set-asides, and then the voters turned that down as well. So we set aside that money. We're not going to take back from that, and we're not going to raise taxes. You could see why we are where we're at.
Well, would not the state of California just be better off calling it a night and filing bankruptcy, and that's it, and just start over? I mean, it seems to me that I don't know what that would mean. I'm completely talking about my rear end about that, and I admit this, but it just seems to me like we are really facing a problem out there in California, and something needs to be done.
There has to be some tax increases. I know in Florida, the Republicans have made some crazy claim, like, we will never, ever raise taxes, ever. So they sit on their butts, and they won't propose any tax increase legislation that's going to, you know, close our budget gap. And that's a real problem to me. That's like opening up a business and saying, we will never, ever raise our prices, ever.
I would like to say we are never paying taxes, ever. That should be a good Republican point.
The thing is that, you know, elected officials have a duty to protect us, and they differentiate the cuts in budgets and whatnot with extraneous things by dividing them into non-essential goods and services. And with regard to the cops and firefighters issue, that's a clear bluff. That's just scare tactics.
But they do it so consistently. I mean, like clockwork. And by the way, I keep forgetting to give this out. 888-228-4494. Give us a call and weigh in on this. Like clockwork, if they want more money, they will tell you your cops, your firefighters, your schools, that's what you're going to lose. And you know, it defies logic to me at how they can sit there now and act as if they can't figure out why it is the voters don't trust them for as far as they can throw them.
Right, because they want to prey on the fears of the voters into thinking that, oh my gosh, when you call 911, no one's going to come rescue you. No one's going to give a crap. But if you do what we want you to do, then all is well and good, and you know, the world will continue to spin on its axis.
Yes,
well,
but now you have a position
defense,
with it.
You know, in their defense, this budget crisis is affecting us. We are, you know, closing down the school. There have been problems.
But your key word there, Mike, is this budget crisis.
Well, this budget
the last 400 didn't.
No one wants to make the hard decisions.
2000. It's not a new thing. And it has affected over. I'm not talking about just at this point in time. Over the course of the years where California has been running in the red, we do have problems out here. Like, you call 911 and they don't answer right away, which is a terrifying proposition. We do have problems where the schools don't have enough money. I hate to say it because, you know, I'm usually with the tax enough already crowd, but the state taxes are not high enough to support the level of services that we have in California, and we have to come to grips with that. Another interesting thing I could toss in there is that in California, the rich, as much as we like to say, throw it on their back, have been paying too much of the state tax. The richest 1% of Californians paid a grossly disproportionate share of the tax revenue, which sounds good, but then when you go into economic downturn and people aren't making tens of millions anymore, you have this tremendous shortfall. So we already had a problem, and now it's just been exacerbated by this economic downturn, you know, times 10. It's become immensely more pressure.
I'm with Jim on this, because I believe that, you know, these elected officials who we entrust to have our best intentions, you know, behind them, they don't want to say, oh, you know what, our budget is crap right now. It's red all over, and we need to take a harder pay cut.
Well, they won't take a pay cut, and they won't tell the public that they have to raise taxes or raise revenue enhancements, however you want to call it. They won't tell people that because they know the instant that they do, some jackass is going to run an ad against them and take them out, because people are inherently greedy. It is about your dollar. And if I can convince you that a 1% tax increase is going to mean the end of your world, when the reality is it means you're paying a penny more for a Snicker bar, but, oh, my God, that's the end of my world, so let me – you know, unless you're buying a big ticket item like a house or a car, it's not going to affect you. I'd be willing to bet you that you could raise the tax, create carve outs for those large ticket items, and you'd still increase revenue without it really affecting the average person. But we will convince people. It's never a $1,500 a year tax increase. It's never a $500 a year tax increase. It's never a $100 a year tax increase, even though your own burden may be $100 a year. It's never a $100 a year tax increase. It's always a $17 billion tax increase.
I was just throwing in a joke. I say you need your echo for your $17 billion.
Unfortunately, we are live from New York today, and I do not have my echo machine.
No echo. I think California's problems really boil down to a couple of, largely to a couple of simple things. One is being the fact that it requires a two-thirds vote in the legislature to raise taxes. And, that's just not going to happen. And the second thing being that we've run so much of the budget through the ballot box that too much of it is mandated.
I agree. We're going to have to continue this conversation, and maybe we'll talk about it next week. I've got a feeling that the collapse of California's economy is going to be going on for a long time. For those of you who don't believe that what goes on in California matters to you, California is the fifth largest economy, not in the United States, ladies and gentlemen, in the world. So that is a very big one for you. 888-228-4494 is the phone number that none of you folks on Twitter want to use. Instead, you are running my Twitter page through the roof. So we have a comment from one of our Twitters who says, again, isn't it easy? Try and stop the offshore tax havens. States would benefit. Obama pledged to do something. Where is he now? The guy can only plug so many holes in the dam at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, please give the man a break. He's got to get things done. He hasn't been in office that long.
I've waited 15 minutes here. Why? Why isn't there a result?
Let's just chill. We are going to talk about the Supreme Court nominee. Justice Sotomayor, who has been nominated to the United States Supreme Court, is being hit from the left and the right. And the right, according to the right, I don't know if we'll call Sean Hannity, but we'll to heck with them. According to the right in general, she is a bastion of left-wing liberalism. However, according to the left, she's too far to the right, and that seems to be backed up a little bit by a White House memo where in introducing Sotomayor, they emphasized how she is more inclined to vote with or to lean towards the Republican viewpoint than the Democratic viewpoint. So my two points here, two questions, are one, why in the world – with the Democratic Senate, Democratic Congress, would the White House be putting out in talking points that she agrees with Republicans? And secondly, if it's true, why in the world has she been nominated? I would venture to say elections matter. And we're losing a liberal justice. He should be replaced with a liberal justice. Now you add to that, there are some issues that I think Mike's going to raise that is legitimate, whether we want to hear it or not. I think that the comments regarding her leanings in the race issue is legitimate debate. I don't want to sensationalize it, but Mike, I'll let you take it from here because I know you had concerns about this, and I want to have a fair, open-minded discussion for the next 7 or 8 minutes about this subject.
Right. Well, I can fill in a couple of problems that I've heard from the right, so to speak. I was also curious, before I get into that, that she was receiving attacks from the left and was getting claims that she sided with Republicans. I'd like to hear if there's any specific issues. Is it the abortion issue or the particular issues?
It's not. Go ahead.
I mean, I guess all I can say is that she's been supported by Republicans since she was appointed to the district court for the Southern District of New York by President George Bush in 92. And, I mean, five current Republican senators have already voted in favor for her nomination. The White House has pointed out that she's known as a moderate on the court, that she forges consensus and agrees with her conservative nominees more frequently than she ever disagrees with them. There's cases where Sotomayor and at least one judge appointed by Republican president were on the three-judge panel. Sotomayor and Republican appointees agreed on the outcome 95% of the time. 95% of the time. And this has been pointed out and asserted by the White House. And, you know, I mean, during 17 years on the bench, she's never directly decided whether a law regulating abortion was constitutional or not. And that's distressing to me. And another thing that's really distressing to me is her gay marriage. She's not ruled on any cases involving gay civil rights. And that bothers me. And the race thing bothers me because, you know, if we're not going to take somebody and say, well, you know, they're black and that's a handicap, then why is she being considered and why are they spending so much time talking about how she's Hispanic? I don't care if she's an albino midget from Russia. You know what I'm saying? Like, no matter how much
if she was an albino midget from Russia, she would not be qualified to be on the Supreme Court.
She's qualified.
She was an albino midget. Hey, it would make for great sensationalist media.
That was the hit from the left, and now we're going to let Mike step up to the plate and beat this poor elderly woman up from the right.
The issues that I heard of that I had problem with is the firefighter issue, where they gave a civil service test, apparently. The people that happened to finish at the top of that test were, I believe, all white and one Hispanic, and she was on a panel. Now, maybe you can help me out with the specifics to this. That refused to rule that that was a civil rights violation. They basically put it on the back burner. Another issue was with taking the state's I had a little technical issue here for a second. It was a state's and guns issue where I'm going to get tongue-tied, but she was basically saying that the federal law or the Second Amendment did not apply in allowing states to enact gun bans.
I'm sorry, I didn't even catch that.
Which part? As far as the gun?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, my information on this is scant, but she mentioned a bunch of areas where Justice Sotomayor had not decided. I was more talking about areas that had come before her or had come before a panel that she was on. And the one issue I mentioned was with the firefighters being discriminated against. I can't imagine a situation in which the state gives a test and then looks at who finished at the top of that test and does not like the race of those people and throws it out. I mean, certainly that's something, if you ask me, where judges should step up and issue an opinion. The other issue that I was mentioning was a guns rights issue where she had taken the state's ability to limit gun rights over the Second Amendment and over federal.
Which would be the issue regarding the firefighters in New Haven, Connecticut, is a very serious one. I think that is we're starting to see a trending of this where we are getting a reversed racism in the United States, where people who are taking tests in the New Haven case, they took a test to get promoted as firefighter. No minorities passed the test or scored high enough on the test, and as a result, the city threw the entire test out, failing to give the job to anybody else solely because they were white, which is by definition It's reverse. Well, I wouldn't even say it's reverse discrimination.
No, I have a problem with that term, the reverse discrimination. It's discriminatory.
Yes.
And I've got to admit that this hits kind of close to home for me because I've recently taken a civil service test with the city, and I can't imagine how I would feel if the city then collected racial data and said, oh, we don't like the way this came out. We're throwing out your test score. Certainly there's got to be a better way to deal with racial disparity than that. Maybe if they made the claim that there was a problem with the test or that the test was not geared to the particular job, or there are ways in which you could assist affected communities without outright discrimination of saying we're throwing out your test score because of your race.
Well, and I think the big problem here, the question that we have to ask ourselves now is this someone that we want to have in the United States Supreme Court in a lifetime appointment, crafting our laws and shaping the bench with as many 5-4 decisions that have gone through this court in the last 20 years? Do we really want to make it 6-3? And are we risking that? That is a serious question. And, Katie, I'll give you this one. I mean, is there anything, realistically speaking, that could be done to stop it? I mean, it seems to be almost fait accompli. Like, why should we even stop by Congress? It's going to be get done. And the left doesn't seem to be – I think this is one of the first issues that the far left, as I would describe them, might actually be able to stick their teeth into Barack's rear end on, because this is one of those issues where they're entitled to a left-winger or at least a decisively liberal judge. They're losing one. And so you got to reshape the balance of the court. Rachel Maddow did this thing the other day with various drinks and mixing a drink, and it was really kind of hilarious to watch because I had no clue as to where the heck she was going with it. But at the end, she made the point that it's not a balanced court, and so you're going to be getting more conservative opinions, especially if you're putting someone on the court that says they agree with the conservative side more times than not. And I know that's okay with Mike because he's a conservative.
More power to the administration.
Yeah. But I mean, there's two raving liberals on this conversation, and one moderate. So I'm not happy with it. I know my two liberal friends are not happy with it. The far right's not happy with it. And is this an example of the president being too cute by half and trying to find middle ground where he should have put his foot down and said, no, I want it my way?
Obama's trying to. Oh, God.
I guess my biggest problem with everything is we have elected a Democratic president, and we're losing a Democratic seat on the Supreme Court, and he should have nominated a Democratic replacement for that seat. And here's my biggest problem for it right now, and to kind of address the question about the problems that this is going to arise, in my opinion, is that everything, you know, in lifetime and kind of in the cycle of the legislative processes, they have a policy window. And I think that there is a big policy window that's coming up for gay marriage and for abortion. And this was a chance to get somebody on there who's going to vote on the Supreme Court in the way that the American people have voted and voiced their opinion in this election. And that right there is my problem.
Well,
that's exactly why I believe he nominated her. He's coming at it from a pragmatic, almost centrist point of view. Listen,
but that's my point. I don't want a
centrist
on here.
But she needs to work within the justices.
No, she doesn't. She's got to vote just like they do. There's no requirement.
She does, but if she votes straight liberal and the other ones vote straight conservative, then the conservatives would win out because there's more of them.
Find me. That's not true. There are a couple of justices there that do not vote conservative or liberal. They kind of swing either way.
But so do
they. Find me one liberal. 95% of the time, voting with the conservatives is not swinging either way. Find me one liberal ruling of Antonin Scalia. Find me one moderate ruling of Antonin Scalia. You won't find it. This is the guy who gave the infamous quote that's been used in Law and Order, that factual innocence is no bar to upholding a conviction. This guy has got no position even being on the court, let alone.
I have another thing to throw in that I think we alluded to earlier as to why would Barack put somebody on the court if you really feel that they're not backing up what he holds as his positions or she's taking too conservative a position. As we all know, at least from listening to the media, he was under a lot of pressure to put a woman on the Supreme Court. And there was also the Hispanic population wanted to see a representation there as well. So do we have a situation where he's trying to pick based on gender and race rather than ideology?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. I would hope that that's not the case, but obviously it is part of the case. There is some politics being played here. There's a wedge being driven.
That's what happened.
The Democrats are trying to yank over more Latinos and Hispanics, the Hispanic vote. The Republicans have been losing it. And politically, in that regard, this is the Democrats' way of striking the knife in the heart of the GOP. However, at what cost? If you strike a knife in the heart of GOP at the cost of your founding principles, you're not going to keep the voters anyway because they're not going to vote that way because the Supreme Court's going to go the other way.
You have to keep in mind that this is why people don't like the term politics in general. There's you can't expect somebody to be ideologically clean and not to play politics. And I think what we see here is a little bit of playing of politics.
Well, yes, but at the detriment of what is the question? And that is
the fact is that no matter who he picked, the GOP had already predetermined that they were going to attack anyone. They already had their arguments all queued up and ready to go.
We're talking about is he putting somebody forward who Democrats themselves don't support? Of course,
what
the GOP is going to attack whoever.
Is what qualifies her as the best person out of 300 million Americans for this job?
Well,
and
it's going to be very interesting to see. We have to watch the hearings. We are going to cut to a break right now. 888-228-4494. On the back side of the break, we are going to discuss two governor seats that the GOP thinks they're going to get their slimy little mitts on. They want to get the governorships of New Jersey and Virginia. And I think a couple of these guys are counting their chickens way before they hatch. 888-228-4494. You're listening to Common Sense Radio. We'll see you on the other side of the break.
Have you added up all the hidden costs behind Walmart's prices? The estimated $1.8 billion taxpayers shell out for health care because Walmart doesn't cover their employees. The lost wages of 1.6 million women who had to take Walmart to court to get paid the same as men. The countless manufacturing jobs lost while America's largest corporation became America's biggest importer of Chinese goods. Behind Walmart's profits, the middle class pays the price. America can't afford it any longer.
Welcome to my tweet. It's me, Gotta Laugh, from the Political Carnival blog, and here I am to recap the week in politics via Twitter. And what tweet spot would be complete without a few tweets about Dick Cheney? Hunter DK from Daily Kos says, Dick Cheney is possibly the most evil political figure to not regularly wear a hat. Most evil leaders wear hats, but Dick is essence of hatless evil. Greg Mitchell of Editor and Publisher says, anyone note the irony and tragedy of Cheney, who helped expose Valerie Plame, today defending and hailing the work of CIA operatives? Cliff Schechter, my old co-blogger, popped in and said, scared to go outside because if I understand the Gitmo closing bedwetters, prisons are as easy to escape as lucidity is for a Cheney. Speaking of Cheney's war, Caroline said, another ignored health issue, PTSD and other anxiety disorders. We will have a nation of traumatized vets when Iraq is done. Trauma for oil. And now a few random tweets. Shock says, I love the new GOP talking point. We tortured just three people 800 times. Last Hand Willie said, Republican Christians ask, are you moral? Democratic Christians ask, can we help you? The Street Poet asks, what would Jesus do? Ooh, ooh, gay marriage humor. Wolfram said, allowing chickens to cross roads leads to a slippery slope that will eventually lead to people marrying road-crossing chickens. And now it's time for another Meghan McCain run. My dad just belly laughed that the New York Times compared me to Jack Bauer's daughter on 24 because he always compares himself to Jack Bauer. Smiley face. I think the New York Times should write a hit piece about every member of my family. Already got three down. My 17-year-old sister can be next. Such amazing journalism. Trader Joe's plays by far the best music of any grocery store. And finally, the man I just ordered takeout from ended our phone convo with rock and roll. I'm going to have to start ending my convos like that. Rock and roll, Jim.
We always rock and roll here, and this is Common Sense Radio. Our phone number is 888-228-4494. I really don't know why I give you guys this phone number out because you don't use it. You keep getting us on Twitter.
Yeah, where are my tweeters?
Your tweeters are on Twitter, and that's what they are doing.
Jim, we do it out of duty.
We do it. They sit on Twitter and they send in their comments, and we keep reading them on the air. We probably should stop reading them on the air to punish them, but I like reading the tweets. Our Twitter name is at Jim Alger, 888-228-4494. Chris is here to discuss the New Jersey and Virginia, I was going to say Senate governor races. I know my buddy Terry McAuliffe is running there in Virginia. And we are going to pass over to Chris, who's going to bring us up to speed with these two governorships that the GOP is thinking they're going to take back. Are they they've been smoking some product here, or they actually have a chance?
Well, they are in the basement, as I've mentioned on previous shows, and they are pinning their gubernatorial hopes on New Jersey's – well, there's two candidates in New Jersey, Lonegan and Chris Christie, who are trying to gain, or I should say, use the experience of Joe the Plumber and Governor Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani. And
oh God, these guys have no new ideas at all.
Yes, and Corzine, who I love, by the way, who is kind of trying to bank, or I suppose I should say, ride the coattails in this case of Barack and Joe, because Corzine is trailing in the election so far.
How far back is he?
He is, gosh, you know, it's kind of unfair to qualify that because we don't even have a GOP candidate right now.
Wait, he's behind the polls and you don't have a candidate?
We have – Corzine's our candidate. He's already – he's the incumbent.
Okay, but GOP's got a primary. So what I'm saying is in an unnamed Republican, do they have a – what you say? You said that he's behind the polls. What is his number? Where is he polling at?
I believe he is 15 points behind, I want to say.
He's 15 points behind an unnamed Democrat?
I believe that if my numbers are correct, and I have a couple of numbers. For instance, a recent poll, Quinnipiac poll, has Christie ahead of Lonegan by 23 points. But Lonegan's actually the stronger conservative nominee, or candidate, I should say. So, you know, it is hard to determine that because you have a GOP in New Jersey. We have a history of recently having GOP candidates, or I'm sorry, GOP governors, with the exception of Corzine. Corzine regained control from, well, Chrissy Whitman was in control for a while, and so it's just a little difficult to judge right now. On Corzine's side, he's a multimillionaire. He used to be he used to run one of the firms on Wall Street, and he's got every ability to bankroll this. So we're kind of just waiting for a GOP candidate to emerge, and the election is next Tuesday. Well, this coming Tuesday.
You're going to have that pretty soon then.
Sorry?
I say, so you're going to have that result pretty soon then, and you'll get some real poll data?
Yeah, absolutely. And in Virginia, we have Democratic Governor Tim Kaine, who wants another shot at the governor's office. And the GOP basically wants to reclaim their numbers. They have nothing at this point.
And when you say that they have nothing, what exactly are you referring to? They're pulling low, or they don't have anybody to be the front man. They don't have anybody for you to target. What are you getting at?
Just the fact that the GOP is, their numbers have been decimated since Obama won. The Democrats haven't had they haven't won in their primaries in Virginia since 1977, I believe it was.
As far as the governor's race?
Right.
I am looking at some of the polling data coming out of Rasmussen, and they are showing the congressional ratings are the highest in 2 years. Obama's still soaring. I'm not seeing anything on the governor's race. It does have limited polling data out of the governor's race in New Jersey, but one would argue, and it looks like you said Christie's ahead in New Jersey. It does. I'd actually call this now. She's got this race.
His name is Chris Christie. Yes.
Yes. I went.
It's
Christie,
Pat.
By the way, I would say he's got this race. So it's going to be Christie, and the it doesn't look like. I don't know. The point I'm getting at is that I'm a little bit concerned about you're saying that Corzine was down by double digits, although this election's in November, it's going to be a swing, and Barack has not been in town yet. So I think that this will be the first shot the Republicans have to indict Obama's policies if they're not working by November. But generally speaking, I don't see this going. In Virginia, I think the Republicans don't have a chance. Now, I'm going out on a limb here. But I don't think they've got a chance. I think that they are a toast down there. I think that Terry McAuliffe, assuming that he gets to the primary, I think Terry McAuliffe's going to have the party machinery behind him. He's going to have the Clintons there. Obama can come in whenever he wants. They're right off the beltway. I don't see for the life of me how, in this environment, the state of Virginia goes against a Democrat. I just don't see it. New Jersey, it's a little bit more away from the beltway. It's a little bit further up. There's a better chance there. But even then, when you're surrounded by Democratic states, New Jersey's not exactly known as Republican bastion either.
The problem with Chris Christie is that he has no plan. He has a lot of fluff.
He's a standard Republican.
Absolutely. And that's why I think it's almost a joke that Corzine is the quote-unquote behind. It's like, behind what? We don't even know who the candidate is going to be for the GOP.
Well, where's that information that he's behind come from then?
The Philadelphia Inquirer published it last week. I don't have that in front of me right now, but I remember reading it.
Their own telephone polling or whatnot?
I'm sorry, you broke up?
Oh, I was saying, was it the paper's own polling that came up with that idea? The paper's own that.
No, I believe it was a Quinnipiac poll. And I had read a couple of things, but I only pulled off one or two, actually two. Two articles off of the internet because I threw out the paper from last week. But yeah, it's just,
okay. By the way, I've got different news here. I've got a poll here that's actually got Corzine in front.
Well, it's about time.
So, but you know, it does look like there are questions as to what's going on here. It's got this one here, the RCP average, which is what you're looking for, Real Clear Politics, has got Corzine down by 7.6. So 7.6 down, we're out, what are we, 6 months out now? This is Corzine's race. He's got
absolutely.
It. He's got
yeah.
it.
And he's going to get, you know, Joe Biden is our southern neighbor. So
let me explain to our listeners how the whole how this works. This is the stuff that they don't tell you. He's down 7.6%, which is what you're seeing here is the low point of the governor, barring something else major coming out, because you've got multiple people who are running against the governor as well as each other. So all you're getting is nothing but negative against the governor. And I've been seeing the ads myself being in New York. I'm seeing some of the ads coming in here because it's the New York market. So, which also plays a toll in this because New Jersey has this unique problem of being in New York and Philadelphia media markets, which are expensive media markets when a lot of the state is nowhere near New York or Philadelphia. However, in other words, it takes a lot of money to run in New Jersey. The issue with these guys is 7.6% down when you're this far out at your low point, which means this is when you're getting beat up every single day, and you're not responding because you're not running right now. Corzine's not running right now. He has no reason to run. He's the nominee. So unanswered fouls, unanswered goals are being scored against Corzine right now, and he's only 7.6% down. When he's firing back, and then he's got Barack, and he's got congressmen, and he's got his entire machinery firing back at the opponent, this guy's toast. So barring something major, I'll make my long-range prediction. I'll say Corzine's got this one.
Absolutely.
And assuming my man McAuliffe makes it through there in Virginia, I think he's got Virginia too. Those are my predictions. I'll go out of the limb here and say that, and we'll see how wrong I am in November.
Well, we have to save the warning. We have to warn the viewers not to, or the listeners, I should say, not to place any bets on our predictions. That hasn't really gone well in the past.
Well, we, you know, some people that I know did pretty good on intrigue with Barack Obama. I know some people that did very good.
We shouldn't mention those people on there, though. That's,
What's funny is that Chris Christie and Lonergan have only been battling each other. Originally, Chris Christie was attacking Obama and the Democratic's positions with Corzine, but then he realized, oh, crap, I haven't won this nomination yet. So then he went back and switched and attacked Lonergan. But Chris Christie has never presented any real plan.
Well, I don't know why you'd expect the Republicans to be any different there. So the GOP strategy right now is they're going
to
roll out Joe the Plumber. Anybody want to place bets with whether or not we'll see Sarah Palin flying into Newark?
Oh, Lord, have mercy.
I think that
would help them to bring out Sarah Palin.
Well, I think that they'll try to bring out the far right wing. Down in Philadelphia, we had another interesting thing occur out there in Pennsylvania, and we'll end the show with this. Some stupid newspaper down there, and I'm not going to mention their name because they don't deserve it, thought it would be a great idea to publish in their paper an ad that called for the assassination of the president. The ad read something along the lines of, "May Barack Obama follow in the footsteps of McKinley, Garfield, Lincoln, and Kennedy." And, you know, first of all, to the depraved individual that placed that ad, I'm sure if you haven't had it already, you will be getting a visit from the United States Secret Service. To the people at the newspaper that put the ad in the paper, if you have a copy editor whose eyes were placed on this and didn't even realize that, well, this is kind of cryptic and what is this, they should be summarily fired. And if you knew what you were doing, I hope you've got your own issues. I mean, that is just ridiculous. I don't care how much you disagree with someone's politics. To call for any type of physical violence to befall upon that individual, with the possible exception if I'd like to see Bill O'Reilly get smacked in the head a couple times with his own cameraman. But beyond that, to call for physical violence against a political opponent has no place in politics, has no place in this country. And for all of you guys who love to wrap yourselves up in the flag and say how much of a patriot you are, to call for physical violence to befall upon the President of the United States, be it Barack Obama or George W. Bush or anyone else for that matter is beyond unpatriotic. You should be ashamed of yourselves for running the ad. You should be ashamed of yourselves for putting the ad in the paper. And that's all I've got to say on this. Ladies and gentlemen, that has been our show for the day, and we are gone. Have a good one. Keep it real.